Call the meeting of the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council to order. We have the tape rolling, Patty?
We do.
Great. So, record show we have a quorum of council members here. Good afternoon, and welcome to those in the audience. Council members have their packets, so we have an agenda. First thing we need to do is take a look at the agenda and approve for today's meeting. As you will see, that the purpose of the meeting today is to get an update, particularly to some of the members who haven't been here at the Capitol on a day-to-day basis for the last couple weeks, about what has transpired and how that's going to affect the council. We're going to ask for public comments, and the focus of the comments, so take a look at backwards about the process that we used for the first recommendations that the council developed, what worked, what didn't work, and use that information as a springboard for developing our recommendations for fiscal 2011, because recall those recommendations need to be delivered to the legislature by January 15th of next year. So we are actually going to be moving at fairly quick pace to develop those recommendations. We have also, as we've talked about, developed a long-term strategic plan for guiding investments from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. There is some legislation that directs that strategic planning process. We need to talk about how that process will unfold. We have Gene Coleman and Steve Hobbs, who have graciously offered some comments, some thoughts about how that might occur. We have asked people who helped lead our collaborative processes, Susan, Tom, I don't know if Ryan is here. He's not here, but we've asked them to give us some thoughts about what has worked, what didn't work so well, how we might improve that. Maybe we should deep six the whole process going forward, but get some input there. And then the council needs to begin a discussion about how it wants to proceed in developing our recommendations for the next set of expenditures from the fund, as well as how we want to go about and develop this strategic plan. My goal is to get enough input. We'll be listening, taking notes, obviously listening to the tape. What I plan to do is bring the executive committee together here in a couple weeks, maybe less than that, and take the input that we received today and put together a proposal, just as we did last January, that will really guide our process and decision-making for the next 8 or 9 months to get those recommendations to the legislature that are due again January 15th of next year. So with that as an agenda, I would entertain a motion to approve the agenda as drafted.
So
any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to add one item. I have a concern about permanent easements that I'd like to address at the end.
Okay. So, Wayne, we would move that just before adjournment?
That would be fine.
Okay. And you will leave that discussion?
Yes.
Okay. So with that one proposed modification of adding a discussion of permanent easements as agenda item number 8, any other modifications to the agenda as proposed and modified? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We have our agenda for today. Everyone had a chance to look back at the last meeting of the council, which was March 23rd. Bill, did you receive any comments from council members regarding any proposed changes?
Mr. Chair, it was us.
Members, motion to adopt the meeting minutes as drafted. Any further discussion on the meeting minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is approved. We have meeting minutes finalized. Legislative update. I've asked Bill to take some time and go through, and of course members of the council that were engaged quite heavily in that process certainly can chime in, but Bill, do you want to take some time and walk the council through what happened, particularly with respect to House File 1231?
Hi, Alan.
Welcome. And as it relates to our work, our responsibilities going forward.
Thank you, Mike. I will. And if at any time any of the members, especially those who were involved in the legislative efforts, would like to chime in, please do. As a preface, I'd just like to say that the legislative process is a learning process, and you hear and receive as much information as you give, and it's important to listen closely to what people are saying as you go forward. So for those of you in the audience, there are copies of the conference committee report on the table. It's an abbreviated edition, an abridged edition, containing only sections that I hope only the sections that are relevant to the recommendations of the council and the use of the outdoor heritage appropriation. So if you turn to your copy, you can see on page one we have the standard appropriation language, and then on page two, well, let me just, I think it's going to be easiest if everybody understands that the recommendations from the council in terms of money were all funded. As a summary, there was one additional project funded from the Outdoor Heritage Council that was heard and not recommended. I think also it's important to know that there were a few minor changes in language and a couple of significant ones, too. So on page two, we come to the first major change from our recommendations. In a number of places, you'll see the legislature inserted language dealing with prairie restorations. This came in the State Department's Finance Committee, Phyllis Collins Committee. The council representatives there were asked whether they agreed with it going in, and we agreed with it going in. The Green Corridor Legacy Program had a few changes, too, all to the better, specifying the constitutional language be followed, and also giving the citation for the outdoor recreation system as Minnesota Chapter 86A. Prairie Heritage Fund acquisition and restoration went in, as I recall, as we proposed it, except that the native seed language was added. And accelerated prairie grassland wildlife management area acquisition was as recommended. Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge Protection. This was an area of some concern. There was, concern about the federal government owning property and in the future converting it. So the last sentence was added to strengthen the reversion clause that's in the in our legislation.
Mr. Chair, maybe just some background on that. I think from the very first committee hearing in the House, and I think the chair and Bill saw that, that Representative Larry Howes had some strong concerns about taking state tax dollars for federal government purchases. And he wasn't alone. There was a very strong feeling through many members of the House on both sides of the aisle. And so that went through multiple committees on having language that would have essentially prohibited the project from going forward. I supported the Tallgrass Prairie portion because I think we don't have a built consequence. So we have kind of two issues that we're going to hear about as we go through here, built consequences. This one was a little different. You don't have a built consequence, but there were members who did not want to be providing any money to the federal government. So the language, the reversionary clause at the end, that if the land was ever transferred, going back to the state, that was an acceptable compromise to the end of House and others.
Thank you. And as Bill mentioned, that clause shows up later on. Bill will talk about it, which applies to any acquisitions of fee title or easement property.
If I don't talk about it, remind me because I'm really clicking on what you said. Bluffland Prairie Protection Initiative went in as recommended. Rum River Cedar Creek Initiative went in as recommended, and I would remind that there's a commitment for a soft commitment for another appropriation for that acquisition in the upcoming fiscal year. Forests, this is not a change from the recommendation of the council, but an elaboration on the recommendation of the council. As you recall, we made recommendations We didn't know what the total sum necessary was going to be. We recommended $20 million. We later discovered that it was $45 million plus $1 million for stewardship. $44 million plus $1 million for stewardship. Our recommendation was to fund the second half of it when we knew what the amount was, and we received information in, just before the 26th of April from the Blandon, the UPM Kemeny representative, that we could release the data on the purchase, or they would release the data on the purchase, and we discovered what the amount was. And so the legislature, in its wisdom, amended the bill at our recommendation and appropriated the full amount for the Forest for the Future's UPM purchase. This was an appropriation that received a fair amount of attention. Subdivision 4, Wetlands Accelerated Wildlife Management Area Acquisition, went in as we recommended it. Accelerated Shallow Lake Restorations and Enhancements went in as we recommended it. Accelerate the Waterfowl Production Area Program in Minnesota is as recommended. Reinvest in Minnesota Wetland Reserve Program Acquisition and Restoration is as recommended. Shallow Lake Critical Shoreline is as recommended. And then we come to the next change, which is in Subdivision 5, Fish, Game, and Wildlife Habitat. As you may recall, in the Outdoor Heritage Conservation Partners Grants Program, we had recommended the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation be the administering entity. We thought that there was a conflict of interest with the Department of Natural Resources, and we heard testimony that the Board of Water and Soil Resources wasn't in the business of habitat. So this was our best recommendation. For a variety of reasons, the legislature felt it was best to have the Commissioner of Natural Resources administer this particular appropriation. You may note that the word pilot is in there. There was some angst about it being a pilot program. Apparently, there was fear that conservation groups would think that this was reneging on the promise or something of that sort. We requested that pilot be taken out, and it was agreed to do that in the revisor's bill. Unfortunately, there was no revisor's bill, which is fine. We later came to learn that the word pilot itself provides a little bit more latitude for the commissioner in the design and execution of the program, and but for the secondary intent, the alternative, it might be a good thing to have the word pilot in here. So we'll deal with that as we go forward. I might add also that there were a couple of minor changes in the prescription of the program. For example, there was language in our recommendations that the program be open year-round and that we have quarterly evaluations. I think that that's something that's negotiable with the commissioner, given the amount of money available. The legislature had amended it to be 2.5% of the appropriations to be used for administering the grant. After looking at the amount that NIFWIF was going to use and what the department said they needed, that was up to 6.5%. We need to enter into some discussions with the department to figure out what this all means in practical terms.
Bill?
Yes.
Scott?
Does the language still provide that of the $4 million in the Conservation Partners Program, half of it is for grants above a certain amount and half of it are for grants below a certain amount? Or could that whole $4 million be used up by 10 $400,000 acquisitions?
Well, let me just say that I don't believe the language does specify that at this point in time. But this is all up for negotiation. The Department of Natural Resources will have to fill out an accomplishment plan. I think that that's a reasonable thing for us to discuss. And the commissioner is not out to do anything bad here, and he'll try to do the best he can under the circumstances to do the right thing and make the program work. And I think that what the subcommittee that worked on this was most interested in was having a program that worked efficiently and effectively for groups, local units of government, and things, other organizations that might want to apply for this money. So we can ensure, I think the purpose of the two-stage program was to make sure that large acquisitions didn't use up all the money and take it away from the small groups. I think if we are careful in our approval of the accomplishment plan, we can ensure that that objective is attained.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just to be clear about, I'm sorry, did you have a follow-up question?
Well, go ahead, Matt, I'll ask my
question. Okay. My understanding of the conference committee's intent was the reason the word pilot program was used, first of all, was because this was a compromise, and the idea was that the House was very reluctant to do the National Foundation to give the money to them, and so the idea was that for 1 year it would go to the DNR while we figured out what the next plan, the long-term plan would be. And so I think there was some misunderstanding of what that word pilot program meant, but that was all that was intended by that, to say it was for 1 year. And then, of course, as you'll see in the language, there was a lot of support for the idea of creating a Minnesota-based foundation, and that's what we're hoping will come out of the next year's deliberations and the report, and that that would be the long-term solution. And so that's what this language is intended to set up. And as Bill said, I mean, you have to follow what's in here. This is law now, but, well, once it's signed, it's law, but the DNR certainly has the ability to make more, you know, to, or, you know, with the council, presumably, to figure out, as long as they don't violate what's in here, they can set up criteria like using smaller grants. You know, there's nothing that limits that in here, so I think
Scott? And my follow-up question would be, do you think the commissioner would be open to allowing to as the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation had encouraged, do you think they would be open to allowing the members of that Conservation Partners Program, but that subcommittee, to act as in an advisory committee? I mean, to the commissioner?
Go ahead, Bill.
Sure. Not. You're asking me to speak for the commissioner, and I haven't discussed this with him, so I can't tell you right now what he would say. I do think we have the considerations of what's legal in terms of legislative entities and executing programs, and so we've got to be very, very careful in this in terms of this. If we were to have members, the structure, the number, things like that, we can't have it done in such a way that a quorum of this council or subcommittee ends up providing advice. So if it's to be done, I would recommend that we do it very, very carefully.
I think the separation of powers question is a real one, and that the concern on authority, that this body is an advisory body that doesn't have the authority to distribute dollars. And with it being in the Commissioner of Natural Resources, that's the executive branch, and all of us in here are in the legislative branch.
I might add that the accomplishment plan process review and approval of status reports affords the council an opportunity to understand and comment on the nature and quality of the grants that are going out. So rather than being proactive, there's a bit of a reactive ability to ensure that the Department of Natural Resources is doing a good job.
Mr.
Chair. Yeah, Bob.
A couple things. One is that I think Senator Anderson, I think what I'm hearing you say is that the legislature is fully in support of a small grants program. How it gets done is yet to be determined on a longer term basis.
Mr. Chair and Bob, I believe so. I mean, I can't speak for the House,
sure,
but I think they are. It's just a matter of how it's done,
yeah,
and who administers it. Absolutely. I didn't hear any hesitation about the concept.
Great. Then, Mr. Chair, I believe it would be as it would be for a committee of the legislature, certainly appropriate that the council might choose to have a hearing and learn from the Department of Natural Resources about how they wish to proceed on how this program might be run. I'm sure they would be mindful of considerations that the council might have about ideas Scott and others may have about how to approach it and so forth. So I don't think it's without, and I have to believe that the DNR would place a value on, a high value, I think, on the council's considerations.
Good suggestion. Rick?
The intent with the dollars right now was to get them into projects. Mm-hmm. So with the commissioner having the 1 year, the $4 million should get into the ground and get into projects.
Mm-hmm. Bill?
I would just like to direct the attention of the audience and members of council to page 8, starting on line 10-7 at the bottom of page 8. I apologize for the lock on there. That's just the way it looked out. Up through page 9, 10-20, that's where the additional language dealing with looking at the feasibility of putting together a Minnesota Fish and Wildlife Foundation came up, and also references something you will see later, this thing called a legislative guide created in this act, and it will weigh in on this issue as well.
Just a couple questions that come to my mind. So as I read, Bill, from 10-7 to 10-15, this report, it doesn't say who the report goes to, but I would presume it would go to the House and the Senate appropriate committees. But this report needs to be done before the department can proceed to start developing and administering this grant program. Is that your interpretation? And maybe I would defer to Ellen or Rick. How do you read that? So this appropriation is available July 1, but the law says before proceeding with this appropriation, which I would assume meaning to develop, you know, hire the staff to develop the program and then start administering grants, they have to do a review of creating a Minnesota nonprofit modeled after the NIFWIP and presumably presented to the House and the Senate appropriate committees. Help me out on that one.
My understanding is that what you say is largely true, that a report of some sort needs to be filed somewhere prior to starting.
So to carry this through, they can't access the appropriation. Greg, help me out. Maybe, you know, feel free to interject. My interpretation is they can't access the appropriation. So if I'm at the department and I need to hire 3 staff, which I think we heard eventually, to run this program, that they have to in-house do this review, submit it, and there's no approval, I guess, but just submit it, and then they can access this $4 million appropriation and start hiring the staff that are needed to actually develop the grant program.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're reading it a little bit too narrowly. I think as a condition of proceeding with this appropriation, the commissioner shall report. You know, it doesn't talk about the timing of when the report's going to come in. I mean, you have other places in here where you say it's a condition you're going to have these reports down the way. We don't wait until the reports are done before the appropriation goes out. I wouldn't read this too narrowly. As I think Representative Hansen said, I think the intent was to get the money out, that this was, but just as a, since they're operating the program this year, as a condition of operating the program this year, the legislature wants some kind of a report on looking at this. I think it would be a better way to read it. I understand that it's probably could have been done clearer. This was done kind of basically, you know.
I agree with Greg.
Mr. Chair, I agree with Greg, because I was reading this and thinking, I don't remember saying that this has to be done before you can give any grants.
That was
certainly
never
not the discussion. And so I don't believe that's the intention. And so it is maybe a little ambiguous, the wording as a condition of, but that's not the intention at all.
Well, let's only state for the record, I like Greg's interpretation. I like yours.
It has to happen. If you'd asked me what this said before I went and looked at the language carefully, which is always a dangerous thing to say, I thought the intention was we get a report by next session.
That was the intention.
Relating to this. Yes. Meanwhile, the grants proceed.
Right. And we, I think we'd have elsewhere about grants being reimbursement based, so cutting the checks, mm-hmm. you know, distributing the appropriation. You can have an RFP and find the projects and you know, dealing with the contracts along a number of steps along the way before you write that check to reimburse it. And I would think that that interpretation is there. But we also want the DNR to start working on it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, not wait till the end.
Any other questions on this appropriation?
Okay, aquatic management area acquisition was as recommended. Cold water river and stream restoration protection enhancement is as recommended. Dakota County habitat protection is as recommended. Lake Rebecca water quality improvement project is as recommended. And Fountain Lake fish barriers is as recommended. Under administration and other, contract management is as recommended. The LCC, the dollar amount is a little different. I haven't figured out exactly why it occurred that way. I believe it's $20,000 difference, and there may have been an error in our bill as drafted or something like that. My recollection is we had $685. So, but it's not a significant problem at this point in time.
So 97A limits the administrative appropriation to 1% of what's appropriated from the fund. And what's appropriated in the fund is 69 and some change. And so that number seems slightly high. Is that's what you were getting at, right, Phil?
This is the wisdom of the legislature, that the number ought to be 705. It carries forward if it's unused and by anyone, I believe. And so, as you'll see later, that we're going to work with the Legislative Coordinating Commission in development of a budget, and these questions can be answered then. I do want to point out that of this amount, 10,000 on line 12.29, of this amount, 10,000 is for the cost of developing and implementing a website to contain information on projects receiving appropriations, which is, you'll see that later.
Rick?
I'm assuming, just based on we haven't had that many meetings for 2 months, but the up to 100 of this for this fiscal year, we're likely not to clock 100K for this fiscal year. I mean, so
as of the last accounting, which was shortly after the accounting I sent to you, we had extended beginning in December $57,000. So I'm not going to comment on whether that's cost effective or not.
Mr. Chairman, before you move on, I just would like to make one comment on the 1%. You don't really have to worry whether this appropriation is 1%. The legislature appropriated this much money to you. If the legislature chose to do 2%, and the statute said 1, this is the specific law. It always overrides the general law. Regardless of what the general law says, if the legislature later appropriates more money, it doesn't matter whether it says 1% in the statute. So I just wanted to clarify, you don't have to worry, you don't have to try to fit this into the 1% because this is what you receive.
Great. Thank you.
Upon signature.
Upon signature, yes. Mm-hmm. That would give you some doubts.
On line 13.1, you see the beginning of the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council site visit exception. This is something that we'll have to implement very carefully. We've been entrusted with some public trust and need to make sure that everything we do is open, but it has to be pragmatic. You may recall that the issue here was having to open up a bus ride to the public and the liability costs that go along with that as well as the cost per se.
Rick?
On this one, I think there were questions raised during the whole process about whether the council will post when the tours are going on, you know, beyond that. There was concern raised that if the council goes on a tour, that the public would not know anything about the tour, like when it was leaving, where it's going to, what the stops are, where the public could engage. So I would think that the intent here that the council should state is that those things will be posted. It will be, you know, if you're stopping at this lake that there's a, you know, and we've got a majority there that's noted on the website and that people can access and the public can be aware, and that the purpose of this is only on the travel. Everything else is public and public can be engaged.
Sure, I just want to point out, I think the language does say that. This travel to and from site visits. Site visits were not accepted from that, so you would have to notify all site visits that you're going to be at with it.
That's all I know. But thank you, Clerk.
Patty, when you do the minutes, just make sure that this is well reflected and very accurate. Availability of appropriation, I believe is as written. Cash advances is as written. I just want to point out that this is permissive to the Commissioner of Finance. It's not required of the Commissioner of Finance. Accomplishment plans is as written. Project requirements, there's more specific language with regard to restorations in here that we accepted and appreciate. I believe that this new language puts this council in a framework that's consistent with the bonding bill, it's consistent with the LCCMR. So we've got.
It's consistent with our budget bill as well, which covers DNR, Bowser, et cetera. So we did put the same language just about everywhere in this session.
So. On page 16.26, there is an addition. It's a reasonable addition and reflects actually the policy that we had going into the development of recommendation. And there was a slight change in the language on line 16.34 that was makes it more affirmative that contact with the Corps, Conservation Corps occurred. Payment and conditions of capital equipment expenditures is the same. Purchase of recycled and recyclable materials and accessibility was the same. There was a lot of confusion over these two subdivisions. And I think it's really important for people to understand that what we're trying to do here is make sure that everyone plays under the same rules. That's all this is. It's not trying to do something to NGOs or something like that. Land acquisition restrictions is as written. Subdivision 15, real property interest report, is as written. And then on page 18, you'll see that there are, we begin a section, section 3, which amends the Organic Act for the LaSard Outdoor Heritage Council, which is in Minnesota Statutes 2008, section 97A.056. And the changes come on page 19, on line 22-26. The Department of Natural Resources is no longer providing administrative support. We are now working with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, who will coordinate the hiring of staff and approve that staff. So they have the right of approval. The council may appoint nonpartisan staff under these conditions and contract with consultants as necessary to carry out the functions.
Maybe we'll just stop. And I mean, this is something that we talked about early on, about the role that this council would play in hiring the consultant or the staff to work for us. Bob, any comment? You're the chair of the Personnel Committee. We've had some conversations with Greg. I didn't hear about this.
Yep.
And anything to add?
No, I think that we'll, in some respects, proceed as pick up where we left off from a few months ago when we were beginning on this effort. We have a draft of a position description, and the council members may recall I sent that out to you, I think, back in January and asked for some input. I'll send that out again. I got a few people to respond, and I'll send that out again in the next few days, probably next week, and ask for your input on that, and then work with Greg Hubinger to begin to map out the plan and the steps for completing that work.
Scott?
So if as we had kind of originally thought, the council will hire its own staff, does that mean that that person is not a state employee then? They are an our employee?
No.
Or they are a state employee?
Mr. Chair, they are a state employee, but they're a member of the executive, excuse me, the legislative branch.
Okay.
So what's important is that to understand is that we will have a role in that selection. We will likely be giving a list of acceptable candidates, like a short list, and then from that we could then look to hire an individual from that short list. But these are members, these are employees of the legislative branch of government.
So, the next set of changes begins at the bottom of page 19 and strengthens the instruction to use and achieve the outcomes of existing natural resources plan and properly cites the Minnesota Statewide Conservation and Preservation Plan that we'll hear from later today, representatives of that plan and others. On line 2331 on page 20, there's some language that instructs us to consult and work with and develop and implement a process to ensure citizens and potential recipients of funds are included throughout the process, including the development and finalization of the council's recommendations. The process must include a fair, equitable, and thorough process for reviewing requests for funding and a clear and easily understood process for ranking. So as we go forward in designing our process for the next set of recommendations, it's important to keep this piece of legislation in front of us and ensure that we accomplish what it requests we do. Also, item H below that, the council should use the regions of the state based on the ecological regions and subregions developed by the Department of Natural Resources and establish objectives for each region and subregion to achieve the purposes of the fund outlined in the state constitution. And then lastly, and this is an important item, the council shall develop and submit to the Legislative Coordinating Commission plans for the first 10 years of funding and a framework for 25 years of funding. Consistent with statutory and constitutional requirements, the council may use existing plans from other legislative, state, and federal sources as applicable. So, as we have expressed in the council, as we were rushing to put recommendations together, that it would be nice to have a long-range or a strategic plan to work with. We are afforded the opportunity here to do that, and you'll see later to work with others in the process. There were a few changes to the audit requirements that existed in 97A. You may recall that they called for an independent auditor. The new language instructs the legislative auditor to audit the Heritage Fund expenditures, including administration and staffing. And I want to point out that, at least in my case, on line 2415, where it says every 2 years to ensure that the money is spent to restore, protect, and enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife, that's a little different kind of audit than say, the Environmental Trust Fund has been subjected to, in my experience. And we're looking for the legislative auditor to audit the effectiveness in our programs in achieving the constitutional instruction objectives. That's good stuff, I think.
Bill, before you move on, I just want to bring up to members' point that I was on an email chain a couple days ago that the auditor was not very happy about not receiving money for this purpose, but there's nothing to audit right now. But it should be probably an issue of discussion for the council, I think, between now and its next recommendations as to how the auditor is going to be paid for doing this service to make sure that the auditor, because these are going to be expensive audits and not just a normal financial audit, as Mr. Becker pointed out. It seems like they wouldn't need to do anything before July 1st of 2010 anyway, so that it didn't seem to matter that there wasn't money in here during the bill this year for it.
Rick?
I should note there's been some stress already about it, and that there was some intent in the last few days there that across all four funds that the auditor would have the ability to look at each of those funds and then do fee-for-service billing at each of those funds. And I think we agreed to that, but I'm not sure if it got plugged in. So there was some desire and intent, not just relating to this fund, but relating to all four funds to have some of that efficacy type of auditing going on. And so I'm sure we're going to revisit that particular one, but Mr. Knopf is right that we don't have anything to audit right now because it's not been expended, but there probably needs to be some correction there.
Okay, Subdivision 7 instructs the legislative auditor to submit reports on this auditing, and then because the Department of Natural Resources is no longer explicitly involved in this, the section dealing with the department's administration of the council is stricken. I believe that's the reason for that. Section 7 is a project that we heard and did not recommend, and it's illustrative of the importance of time and place, and news and history occur and things change. And as you may recall, there was the discovery of emerald ash borer, and this is an appropriation that's it's written for forest pests, but my understanding is the initial intent is to use this $2 million for A, planning, and B, protection or restoration with regard to the emerald ash borer. Section 8.
Excuse me.
Bob.
Yes, sir. Chair, just to make note that was Bill Miller just mentioned the testimony on the conference committee regarding this.
If you're referring to the fact that this particular appropriation is outside Section 2, I believe it is, where the accomplishment plan authority, and it was agreed and stated on the House and Senate floor that this would come under the accomplishment plan authority, so to speak, of the council, so that we have knowledge and understanding of how the money is being spent.
And maybe, Bill, just kind of another really important part of what this would fall under, if you go back to page 14, line 16.22 to 16.25, one of the provisions that all of the projects that are being funded from the Outdoor Heritage Fund is that the restoration and enhancement work have to occur on land permanently protected by a conservation easement or public ownership, so that this appropriation would also be subject to those provisions as well. So that's an important thing to note, Helen.
Mr. Chair, I know we did talk about that, and I just learned just a couple minutes ago from Rick that the revisers bill didn't pass. I didn't realize there was a filibuster in the House, and they were never able to pass it on the last night. And so this was intended to be corrected in the revisers bill, and that was agreed to, that it was. So, I mean, technically under law, this does not apply, but there is intent that suggests that was our intent, you know. So, that's where it is. And a little bit ambiguous, but that was certainly the intent that we talked about.
Could I just quickly add on to that? Senator Anderson stated that it wasn't going to be in the revisor bill. I also talked to Ms. Cheney from the Department of Agriculture, and she informed me that she'd be happy to have the commissioner write a letter to the commission, to the council, stating that effect.
Right. That would be very helpful.
That they intend
to follow all the requirements.
To the public, yes. They own.
To follow all the requirements that are in Section 2 for other money.
And I should, no? I'm sorry, I should well, comment. Last night I had a community meeting in my district because I represent the area where the emerald ash borer was found, and about 100 residents there, and that was what I told people, that my understanding, but I didn't realize that the law hadn't actually passed, but that the dollars were limited to publicly owned land or protected, permanently protected land.
Rick? And also on the intent, because I've heard in the last few days that the intent of that language was to exclude metro areas because of the hunting and fishing question. Just letting you know what I've heard, that that was the purpose of that. That I, the intent was not to exclude metro areas.
So it was not just a
chair of intent?
No, I don't think there's anything in the record to that effect.
Well, yeah. I'm just telling you what I've heard in the last 2 days, that that was the purpose of that revisor's language, was to exclude metro areas. And I want to be clear that that is not it. That if there are public boulevards in St. Paul where ash trees are getting taken down, they're part of a forest just as much as anywhere else. And
yes.
So they should, the protection or detection or things involved with this, that should be eligible. And I think that under the language that's discussed here and then cited on the floor, that they would be eligible. And if they're not eligible, I don't think that's a correct interpretation.
So the law, or the language, as we put together and was adopted by the legislature, is public ownership
mm-hmm.
or permanently protected by a conservation easement. So it would need to be one of those two categories. And for members who want to just listen, because this was stated not only in the conference committee by Representative Murphy, but she also restated that on the floor of the House that night when the bill was passed, as did Senator Pogemiller on the Senate floor when the bill was being heard in the Senate. So you can go through the House or Senate websites, and if you want to listen to those comments specific to this, you can do that.
And Mr. Chair, I agree with that, and it was definitely the intent of the conference committee. It was just an error that that was left out. But I do want to caution people that legislative intent does not override what's in law. I mean, what's in law is law, and legislative intent can guide what happens, and it can certainly direct people to do that. And I think that's what should happen in this case, that it can be, the agency certainly have the ability to limit it to those criteria. And so if everybody intends that to happen, I think that's what will happen. But I also agree that the intent was of the conference committee, we talked about what public land meant, and we knew that this could be available anywhere in the state that was publicly owned land. And we had a lot of discussion about the impact on all of the forest if this is not contained, wherever it is. And so there's definitely a need to react wherever it's found, whether it's in a city or a small town or in a rural forest, that we need to act quickly.
Are we ready to proceed? Section 8 is the advisor's instruction of the effective date of this.
July 1.
We are the Lassard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council. Everybody knows that honors Dallas Sands, who was a fine man, a great senator, and who worked hard on this amendment as well as Bob Lassard. I have not included Article 2, 3, 4, and 5. 4. Article 5, governance, is included. Section 1 cites three definitions that are added later to 8402 and clearly says that they apply to all funds appropriated and purposes authorized under the Clean Water, Parks and Trails, and Outdoor Heritage Fund. Section 2 is a section that in the interest of transparency and the public understanding how this, these important dollars are expended, sets up a series of public information steps and in uses the Legislative Citizen Commission on the, Legislative Coordinating Commission to do that. On line 87, begin the things that need to go on that particular website and be provided to the LCC, such as information on all project proposals received by the Outdoor Heritage Council and the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. We do that. LCCMR does that, so it's not a problem. Information on all projects receiving funding, including proposed measurable outcomes and the plan for measuring and evaluating the results. We do that partially right now to the best of our ability. Number 3 is measured outcomes and evaluations of projects as required under and cites 97A.056 subdivision 9, which did not get into the statute. So we have some discussion to take care of there. Education about the areas and issues of the project's address, maps and things of that sort. And on down to item C, in which the Legislative Coordinating Commission shall be responsible for receiving all of the 10-year plans and 25-year frameworks. And we noted earlier that we have a requirement to produce that, and the commission will provide assistance and oversight in these planning efforts, which is good, and shall coordinate public access to hearings and public meetings for all planning efforts. And I want to say that the Legislative Coordinating Commission has been a great help to you as a council thus far, and I assume they will be in the future. Section 3 is amending the Department of Natural Resources statute, the main chapter dealing with the department, and it adds three definitions. The definitions are in the context of ecological value and ecosystems. I think that our policies and our request for proposals certainly largely intended that all the things we funded be ecologically sound projects. Section 8 defines a legislative guide that will be developed by January 15, 2010, the purpose of which appears to be to guide expenditures from the accounts, which is a good thing, too.
Can I just comment on that? I think this is going to be a really important endeavor, and the council is a part of that discussion. We're not, we're not sure exactly when this will unfold, but obviously it has to be done this year. And so the council will be involved developing a lot of the things that, if you recall, are guiding principles. Some of the things we had in our first round of the criteria we had for making some decisions and judgments about projects, that will be part of a larger process to look at those types of principles and outcomes as it relates to not just our fund, but all four funds. So this could be a fairly significant, I suspect it will be a significant undertaking, and how the council gets engaged as a body of the whole, as members, a committee, whatever, we just don't know that yet. But it will be, it'll take a fair amount of time over the next 8 or 9 months.
Mr. Chair, just a clarification on that, too. You will notice that it says that enacted on by the legislature. So if it, so this would be basically, it's a recommended guide after it leaves the committees, but it would have to be acted on by the legislature to become an actual legislative guide, which I assume would be by law.
Okay. Section 9 is more instruction on the 25-year strategic plan, and specifically to the Outdoor Heritage Fund, there's language on line 92.33, and importantly, language starting on 93.4 that indicates that we must base our plan on ecological sections and subsections established by the Department of Natural Resources, current science, and achieve benefit across all ecological sections within the state. Interesting. Section 10 is a logo developed by the competition, sponsored by the Minnesota Board of Arts. This logo will go on all signs for all funds. And it's going to be an interesting process. And that is, as I know, the end of the bill.
Yes, Bob.
Phil, do you want to just touch base on the definitions on 88.13? Just make note of the testimony on the House and Senate floor regarding those.
That's right. There's a difference in these definitions and the definitions we used to make recommendations to the legislature in the 2009 session. And as a clarification, And I believe it had to do with the timing of our recommendations and the legislative guide and things of that sort. It was stated by the Representative Mary Murphy on the floor, and I'm not sure who it was,
Senator
Pogemiller, that the council could continue to use its more restrictive definitions in the upcoming round, and that these would apply later in later rounds. I assume that wasn't stated. I assume that.
So what Bill's referring to is recall back on the document that we put together in early January that guided our decision making. We had definitions of protect, enhance, and restore. And the practical implication is that these are the definitions that we can use in developing our 2011 recommendations to the legislature. Any questions? A lot of information to digest. Just while you're, if you have questions, Darby, please.
I don't have a question. I do want to make a comment once we're about to leave this section before we get on to the public comment.
Any questions about the legislation? The bill has not been signed into law, so everything is obviously contingent upon it being signed into law. And then it would become effective July 1. Rick?
I think just on the protect question, because it's in the statute twice, it becomes law. The legislature, 67-0 and 104-30, the definition of protect, the protect equals acquisition. Versus protect includes acquisition, I think is the key point concerned by the legislature, that protect is more than just acquisition. And with our RFP from the council, it has protect equals acquisition. And, you know, the council members don't sit on the House floor or the Senate floor or the committees and listen to hours of speeches about acquisition of land and bills introduced to stop any acquisition of land and bills being introduced to sell land. And I want folks to realize that it is a real, real issue, not one person's issue, not one person's definition, not a passing issue, but one that is significant. And so the legislative intent relating to protect is that it's more than acquisition. That provides you with a broader flexibility for use of the funds.
Any other questions? I just want to say thanks particularly to our legislative members of the council for all the hard work in shepherding our recommendations through. Darby, you were there days and nights, and Bob as well, Jim Cox, who isn't here today, and of course to our two other legislators, Representative Gunther and Senator Ingebrigtsen. A lot of thank yous from myself as chair and I know other council members for your commitment to help move our recommendations through. I really appreciate it. Darby?
Yeah, just what I wanted to say really kind of piggybacks quite well on what you just said. I'd be remiss, I think, if I did not respond to really a comment that was included in a St. Paul newspaper column a couple of days ago in which a couple of House members were, as I see it, really vilified, and I think very inappropriately so. And, you know, I hope at some point we can get to the place where we can vehemently disagree with folks and yet not lead them to vilification. I'll never forget as a young House member watching two members on opposite sides of the floor arguing like mad. I mean, I thought they were going to start throwing stuff at each other. It was that intense. And when the session adjourned, those two people walked arm in arm to the state office floor. And I think to impugn the integrity of a couple of House members in that paper column was highly inappropriate. In fact, the two members who were identified have probably done more conservation and environmental stuff in this state than pretty much anybody else have an outstanding record. So again, we all disagree, and we disagree very strongly, but I hope it ends there. I hope we can get on. Of course, we don't control what people write in newspapers, and I'm well aware of that, but I think we really need to keep that in mind. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Wes?
Thank you for saying that. I appreciate that very much.
For the last 30 days where you guys have been active in the sessions, I've been outstanding in my field, literally, planting food plots and working, but we've been in close contact with the discussions and things that transpired out here. And I think one of the things that I see is sometimes it's a definition of terms that gets us confused. The reference to ecological value of land and water sometimes is very hard to quantify and qualify. The hunting and fishing community is a force of about 1.6 million people out in the state of Minnesota that is out in the woods and the waters every day of the week, 365 days out of the year. And this is kind of our indicating factor. The health of the ecology is measured by fish, game, and wildlife. Not that we're bloodthirsty killers that are all out there to harvest all the animals out there, but by watching the ducks, fishing in the lakes, that group of people out there, and that's why this wording in the Constitution was so important, so critical, and this simple measurement criteria of sustained fish, game, and wildlife, I think is so ultra important, and it doesn't disagree with the ecological value and diversity that we're referring to either. It's two methods of measuring a common objective that we're after, to maintain the health of the environment. And the fish, game, and wildlife is an indicator, if they're healthy, to the sustainability of the human species as we see it also, because we're next on the list. So the hunters and fishermen and the sportsmen out there that we tend to associate with more so are our measurement criteria, and to work with the ecological balance of the systems, I think, is very, very important too. And to meld the two together, we're not in disagreement with the ecological definition, but there's other ways to measure it also, and probably a lot simpler ways of measuring it. Just a comment and statement of that fact.
Any other comments? You know, I again, as I reflect back of what happened and kind of how people perceived us, it was really almost a birthing experience, a new entity, and a lot of pain with a new birthing experience. But I think what was really helpful, I remember Representative Morgan and I had a conversation in one of the waning days of the session, walking into conference committee, and we were both smiling, saying, you know, by the time the session convenes next year, we hope to be know each other, and we expect to know each other on a personal level a lot better. We've had a chance to visit, informally a couple times in offices, but mostly in hearings. And I think part of it is just folks getting to know who we are and us getting to know better who they are and where they come from. And I think, Les, you said it very well, that we're not here at opposing objective. We're all trying to strive for the same thing, which is to create a better outdoors and natural environment. And I think sometimes that gets lost when we get into the heat of debate over words or phrases. But I think this is probably one of the rougher patches, and hopefully the roughest patch that this council will go through in its, hopefully, 25 years of existence. Rich?
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, but I don't think anybody else around the table has been put in print that they can never be trusted again, as I have, and Representative Leeds. And that's what was written. So, if that's true, I guess I'd like to know that. I can never be trusted again. Because during this process, I was working all around the clock and missed most of the debate on the floor on this bill because I was in another conference committee trying to resolve problems with the Game and Fish Bill, which would be the conservation bill. And I think that often there's a misunderstanding how the legislative process works, that disagreement by constituent groups is not the same as disagreement among peers. And I think that I'm trusted by my peers both in the House and the Senate. And that's how legislation gets done. And there are members who are not trusted by the peers. And legislation doesn't get done. So I carried this bill through and it got to the floor and got passed. But I have to read the paper every morning to see when the next attack is. And I have to hear from people that people in the outdoor community are going to come and get you. I don't think anybody else around this table has to hear that.
I've had my share of that. But only the legislators.
Mr. Chair, in response to that comment too, Rick and Alan, you know, we're in a public position right now, and I think sometimes we have to get a little thick-skinned let a little of that run off the back. I think we have to look at the end results, and I think we have to look at what we're going to accomplish, and I think we have to look at what we're going to accomplish as far as enforcing the constitutional law and the wishes of the state of the people of Minnesota. And I think a good, honest, open debate, and, you know, I've been castigated, criticized, and thrown rocks at you, and sometimes you have to just look at it and say, hey, that's past history, now let's go forward and move on and decrease a little bit of sensitivity. I think in a public position, and we go out in the field also. I've been to many, many meetings, and they're after us, too, as far as not obeying the wishes of the people, the wishes of the law, the wishes of the Constitution. Well, it takes some explanation and some countering of that once in a while, sometimes standing toe-to-toe and describing the facts. But let's go forward and look at some of the past angers that have existed and have been thrown back and forth. Let's go forward on a new day. That's what I would suggest.
Any other comments? Otherwise, I'd like to move on. We're an hour plus into a three-hour meeting. We have some important discussion with the council, but thanks for all of your comments. The next item, item number five on the agenda, is public comments. And, Bill, you've received some written correspondence from individuals.
This has been circulated to members, but I figure that given the way everybody's life has been in the last 5 weeks, I probably have a copy or get some copies around. And the authors of two of these, Conservation Minnesota letter and Mr. Cobb, are in the audience if we want to ask questions of them. And other than that, I'd like to begin, I think we should begin with the people who were involved in the collaboratives last time and then get to the general public comments.
Great. So we had set aside some time. Recall, council members, we asked for people to step up to the plate to help organize around those resource theme areas that the Constitution allows for the Outdoor Heritage Fund to be spent on, namely prairies, wetlands, forests, and then kind of a catch-all, which really focused a lot on the aquatic systems, not exclusively. So, and we've asked Tom and Susan and Ryan if they would just spend a few minutes with us reflecting back as the people who helped really shepherd those processes through the system, and what worked really well, what didn't work, how we might change the process, maybe not do it at all as we move forward. So, at this time, did you want them to go through one at a time, Bill, or did you want them all to...
I asked them to organize themselves.
How would you like to proceed?
We are disorganized, Mr. Chair. So
it's all a relative term.
One at a time.
Let's start with you, Tom, if you would. Just again, since you're disorganized, I don't want
to... As the acknowledgedly disorganized. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mike, and council members. I had provided Bill a copy of my bullet points. Bill, did you know that I got into the
package?
And let me pass it out because it's the fact that you delayed this by a couple of weeks gave me even more time to think about it, and it is, frankly, something to think about a lot. And, you know, I want to start out. I'm stunned that this has not yet come up yet, but I want to congratulate you.
this was an outstanding accomplishment. I had a chance yesterday to look at the conference committee report, and I had not much paid attention to the water end of this before, but the combination of the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the water fund is stunning. This is absolutely stunning. When you see the work that's being done on behalf of conservation, this is truly, truly a remarkable day. I think you all need to be thanked for that and acknowledged for that and recognize what has been done. It was really truly quite impressive, I think, at the beginning of the new generation. Bill sent out some guidance on things that he thought you would like to hear. I want to first just touch on the last process before I get into the new process, but let me give you some kudos on what I think worked especially well last time. And I think that there were five of them that identified. First is that your selection process was based on science and existing resource plans. So it gave you a framework, and it gave you the background information that many of the stakeholders have already put into thinking about what ought to be done. You encouraged collaboration. Too often, when there's an RFP out, everybody's in competition. I think it was very beneficial to think about how can we collaborate to get things done. I think you saw in a number of the projects that there was extensive collaboration. You showed some willingness for big projects. Very early tomorrow morning, I'm taking my kids up to Boundary Waters, and I think, what if all we had done was 100 acres at a time, 300 acres at a time, 500 acres at a time? We wouldn't have Boundary Waters. We need big projects, and we encourage you for the appetite for taking on big projects. I think there was stunning or outstanding visibility and transparency in this process. I've, of course, been more plugged in than most, but there was an abundance of opportunity for people to come to meetings just like this and provide their input. And I think the bottom line is the 19 projects that you ultimately identified were a great slate of very worthy projects, and I think you can be very proud of that. Now, you asked for four specific things to talk about in the future, and I'm going to start out with my very first own editorial comment. Do it different. Don't do this again the same way next year. The collaborative process really, as much as I support it, was a function of the fact that you had 4 months to go from zero to 60 miles an hour, and was, I think, a necessary evil. I don't think that is necessarily the model that I would encourage you to follow. Encourage you to follow in the future. So let me touch on your four things. Things that the council can do to improve the request. I think, and this has already come up in the legislation, a strategic framework that draws on the existing plans, I think, is going to be very beneficial. And one of the challenges I think people had is in looking at the guidance from the council, what is the council really looking for? There were certainly some good guidelines there, but it wasn't really 100% clear. And I think the request that you make can help in two ways, and that's under item 1B there. Provides more specific information on what you'd like to see in the request. If not a clear definition of outcomes, and I use an example, 10,000 acres of WMAs, then at least some of the priorities, some clear definition of priorities that you want to have emphasized. And for example, the North American Wetlands Conservation Act, which is a 18-year-old funding mechanism that operates all across the United States, uses a scoring system based on priority criteria from the Council, North American Wetland Conservation Council. And I would encourage you to look at least these six things that I identified. The statewide impact of the project or the size of the project. I think you really do have to look at the County Biological Survey as the foundation for conservation of the state. There's really a lot of good information, a lot of good work that's been done there to identify the remaining native systems in the state, and I think those deserve a higher level of consideration. I think you have to look at the unique nature of aquatic habitat. I mean, we struggle to figure out how to do aquatic conservation because all we think about is that sort of water-land interface. We do the shoreline stuff, we do the AMA stuff, but it's very often is the watershed, and sometimes it's stuff between the banks of the water body as well. So I think you have to consider water a little bit differently than on the land. I think you have to focus on the construction of networks, that is, blocks of habitat connected by corridors, especially with the specter of climate change. And we anticipate that animals can move pretty easily. It's much more challenging for plants to move, and we need to have those networks in place. I think you have to look at the urgency of the crisis and the rates of historical loss. We've got 180,000 acres of native prairie left in the state, and we're losing it. And 90,000 acres that is protected, 90,000 acres, half of what we have left is completely unprotected. And I think that, in my own personal opinion, professional and personal opinion, I believe that ought to be the single highest priority for the council. And I think you have to look at leverage and collaboration. Obviously, we want to encourage both. I think the geographic boundaries, as has already been apparently clarified in the statute, is a better framework to build around rather than habitat type. So this came up multiple times for the collaborative coordinated material. You'll hear that. We helped put together the forest and the prairie park, and somebody would come in and say, well, our forest has wetlands in it, or our prairie has forest in it. How do we measure this? And, you know, it's a false distinction. I mean, it's always stunning with wetlands, and I've been involved in wetlands my whole life, that we think of them as a unique system, but they're not. They're either wetlands in grasslands, or the wetlands in forests, or the wetlands associated with floodplains. They're connected to another part of the system, and I think it makes much more sense to look at a geography, a watershed, or an ecological subsection, and do your planning, your requests around that geography, and as a result of that, your protection of forests, your protection of wetlands, protection and conservation of grasses will come out of that. And I think, obviously, allowing more time for proposals to be developed. The amount of time we had to put these things together was so short that I'm sure we could have done a much better job in putting those together. Things you can do to make collaboration easier. The first off, as I'd offer, is recognize the limits of collaboration. I mean, I get along outstandingly with Ryan. I get along outstandingly with Susan. But our missions are very different. And so it's hard for us to sort of cram together in a collaborative unless we've already got some overlapping interests to begin with. So I think recognize the limitation of the collaboratives. Again, use geography and clear priorities. One of the things I would suggest, and Mike, you and I have talked about this, I've talked to several people about this, is I think at some point we need to better engage local citizens, whether it's local units of government, local conservation activists, however we want to frame that up. Because ultimately, I think, especially with the protection part of this, we're going to start getting the colonies opposing the land that's being set aside, whether it's because of its pelt or it's setting taking away economic development, whatever it is. I think we have to demonstrate back to the colonies that, in fact, their citizens want this. And if all of conservation is sort of top-down, we shall do this to you, without any ground-up, I think it's going to fail, and I think we need to figure out how to engage that local citizenry. I think another suggestion I would make is consider invited proposals. One of the things that I think was a priority for people going into this, and yet is probably not being adequately addressed, is how do we manage the existing base of state land? And, you know, the DNR, and Danny Simon will get up here and tell you they've got ongoing needs and they're going to have ongoing requests. But in the absence of sort of a specific proposal to do that, and most of the organizations are not going to come to you and say, we want to help manage wildlife management areas. I'm not going to come to you and say that, with the exception of the native grasslands. I think one of the things you might think about is, well, what if you do want to launch an initiative to improve, enhance, restore state wildlife management areas, and you set aside X number of dollars, and you say, groups, collaborate, come together to us with a proposal on how you will improve wildlife management areas. Ryan can get to you on wetlands, I can get to you on grasslands, deer hunters can get to you on forests, DNR can come in with an element of it. We can collaborate on specific requests like that. So I think that would be something to keep in mind. And the last thing I'd recommend under collaboration is just liaisons and other funds. Again, I was really stunned to look at the water package and see what's in there. It's awesome. There's a tremendous amount of overlap. I was completely unaware of it. I'm in this business. I should have known what was in it. I didn't even know it until I looked at it. So I think there's an obvious overlap there, but there's perhaps less obvious overlaps with the parks money and with even other ongoing programs. Things I would offer for opening the process more widely. First off, I think you did a great job of opening the process widely. There's a lot of coverage. Of course, it was an inaugural year, so you get more coverage as a result of that. But I think continue the marketing and public outreach as you do, and find additional venues to get the word out to perhaps audiences that aren't included right now. I think as you define your small grants process, you want to identify perhaps what makes that different from the large grant program. Why would I come to you with a $400,000 small grant request rather than try to put it in as a large grant? There ought to be some distinctions between those two. In the case of NACA, for instance, it's a much easier process on small grants and different reasons more. So I think to the extent you can distinguish those and give us the guidance on what those distinctions are so we can apply, I think that would be very helpful. Finally, and you know, most challenging out offers, keep it simple. You know, I've been involved with tens of scores of grant programs in my 30 years. One of the easiest ones is the DNR's Heritage Enhancement Grant program. Very simple, both in the application and administration. I'd love to see that. I work with NACA. I work with NIFWIF. I'll tell you, they are both much more challenging grant programs, and I think to the extent you can keep it simple, you will keep more partners in the game. I for years swore off doing knock grants because they're so darn complicated. They just simply were not worth the money. So I'd say keep it simple and you'll keep more people at the table willing to work with you. And finally, the fourth thing, things you can do to prioritize requests for the council's information, I think a scoring system would be very helpful. And again, NACA uses a scoring system. You know that if you get a 72 in NACA, you have a high degree of likelihood of getting funding. If you get a 50, you're not likely to get funded. And you can figure that out as you're putting a proposal together and you can see where it's weak. So it gives you immediate feedback on how to improve your proposal. And the last thing I'd offer there is I think, you know, you've talked about an emerging issues fund. You actually held aside some money. The issue I see you had with that this year is you had money in a reserve, but you had no appropriation language to allow you to spend it. I think if you can figure out what the guidance would be for yourself as to when you would release it, and use the Emerald Edge Board as an example. If a pest emergency should come up that we would like to act on very quickly, we would ask for a specific authority and appropriation that would allow you to release it at a later date. So 6 months from now, you could go tap that fund. In the absence of having some sort of trigger mechanism, you aren't going to be able to tap that money until another legislative session comes. So I'd encourage you to think about how to set that emerging issue criteria up. And just three last things I'd offer is, I'm going to pass out another piece of paper here. The language, I think it's in the appropriation bill, it was at once upon a time also in the policy language, that any restoration or enhancement money can only be spent on lands that are publicly owned or those subject to a conservation easement. This may be a little self-serving, and I'm going to have to out a little bit of that. The Nature Conservancy owns 70,000 acres in Minnesota. 50,000 of our acres are open to hunting. And the map I'm passing around right now will show you where those lands are. We own more land open to hunting in Minnesota than all of the other conservation organizations combined. Deer hunters, duck hunters, peasants, you name it. We own more land than anybody. Under the current language, we cannot apply for funds to help manage these lands. Now, that's our business. We're going to continue to do it. I don't have any problem with that, but I'd offer that at least 20,000 of these acres are going to be transferred into public ownership in the next 3 years. 20,000 acres are going to become national wildlife refuge, state wildlife management area, state forest, or some other public land. Yet we can't apply for the funding right now to help make those lands better that are ultimately going to be in public ownership. So I'd encourage you to consider how to make something like that more palatable if you think that's a good use of funds, and I personally do. Some policy recommendations I think you ought to consider. I think it would be helpful if, to the extent you can think of policy recommendations that might address legislative concerns or some of the concerns that you're bringing up yourself. Payment in lieu of taxes, for instance. One of the problems with the state wildlife management area system or other public lands is that they can generate income, whether it's through logging, whether it's through grazing, whatever, or cropping. There's a lot of cropland in a lot of management. But that money goes into specific pots and it's used for specific purposes. Not that they're inappropriate purposes, but you have an opportunity with this new funding source to rethink that. If you so choose, you could encourage the generation of income off of some of these lands and put that into a pot that might help pay for kilt or for ongoing land management expenses. So I would encourage you to think of the income generating opportunities from the lands and see how that might help you with some of these other financial issues. Encourage local unit of government natural resource planning with substantial citizen input. I think that would be a really nice complement to the delivery system of natural resources in the state if we could help foster that. I think when we look at the amount of money going into natural resources now as a result of this, there's going to have to be a substantial additional capacity. And I think you have the choice of deciding is that government employees, whether it's local, state, federal, is that nonprofit employees, is that more TNC employees doing this delivery, or is it something else? And I would frankly think that if you don't grow more private jobs in the conservation business out in the countryside, you're really missing an important component here. You can have Jane Smith going home at night from her nursery where she's just doing a bunch of local eucalyptus seed for a restoration project that was funded ultimately with this money. You're going to have people in the community that are bound and determined to see this program succeed. I think that would be an excellent outcome. This has been brought up before. Funding for projects is very helpful. It extends beyond 1 year. We may buy a piece of land this year, restore it next year. I think
including some consideration for that, is helpful. And I think exploring bonding capability is useful as well. You won't have a Upper Mississippi Forest project coming up ever again, I would offer. You won't never need $36 million in one fell swoop ever again, most likely. But having the ability to bond may allow you to deal with more urgency. And the last thing, and this is nothing, no surprise to the council, I would really encourage, the two C's, communication and compromise. It's, once upon a time, when I was in college, I knew everything. By God, you couldn't tell me anything, and if you did, it was wrong, and I knew it, and I made sure you knew it. And you know what? As I've gotten older, I found out, this may be because of my wife, that I am, in fact, not always right, and in fact, I will sleep better at night if I listen and if I compromise. And I think that would be my message for the day, is I think we all want the same thing. I think to the extent we can listen, to the extent we can find common ground, I think we're going to be better served. Mr. Chairman, those are my comments, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Great. Thank you, Tom. Again, Tom helped coordinate two of these collaboratives, the forest and the prairie one. And so we again offer our thanks. Questions, comments?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Wes.
thank you, Tom. With your inputs and recommendations, we were able to do our job a lot better, too. You hit on two elements here that I think are extremely important. Pilt, as you alluded to, Rick, Representative Venus, you were at the DNR roundtable. There was a discussion in committee hearings committees that was discussed quite extensively. Pilt is a problem. Pilt is either a perceived problem or a real problem or both. We've talked with the county commissioners from Otter Tail County. The commissioner has been struggling with this. Our tax assessor, Bob Moe, has been struggling with this in coordination with the DNR. I've challenged the legislators to assist in getting this job of Pilt remodeled, revised, reworked, overhauled, whatever it takes to do, but we're going to have to address it. We have to look at how do we sustain the Pilt payments is part of the element of acquisition, procurement. We have to look at how the counties are going to have to work with it as far as taxation and assessment. And right now the counties, we have 10, probably 11 counties by now that have no net gain within the state of Minnesota, no net gain as far as land acquisition. There's something wrong. We have to address it, and I think we need a joint legislative, LUG, citizens involvement to put this thing on the front page and start addressing it. So far, nobody has stepped forward to take the initiative in this. I talked with the commissioner of the DNR, and I said, you guys are going to have to get out of the assessment taxation role. And Commissioner Holson said, we're not in the taxation assessment role. I said, well, it sure appears to be. So we've got a problem. And whether it be a real problem or an imaginary problem, we're going to have to determine that and solve it. And I think one of the elements is to put a lot of that taxation assessment down at the local government unit level. Encouraging more citizen input. Talking with the DNR, talking with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, SWCD, the biggest problem they have is liability. We get the citizen's input, how are we going to have the liability? Not an excuse, not a good reason for not getting them involved. We handle it as a business. They can handle it just like we handle it through proper insurability and protection. We have to get citizens' involvement to expand the workforce that's out there right now. Thank you for your input.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Bob, just a couple things to respond to Wes. Representative Hansen, Wes has got the Legislative Audit Commission looking into the issue of the Pilt, and then coming back with a report, I guess, in December, I think November, December. That is this, I think, foundational data gathering that's necessary to allow the legislature to consider that. So I think, and I know you weren't around us, but during the legislative process, there was an enormous amount of discussion and a number of different proposals about how to address it. And I think Representative Hansen's approach to having a legislative auditor do the initial work, gather the data, I think is the right step. And I think that was, because that was in play, other ideas that were out there to deal with management costs associated with taxes were put on hold and in abeyance until we get that work done. So I think I'm optimistic that we'll be, I'm not sure we're going to ever solve it, but I know we'll have a lot more data to say that point. I could also follow up with Tom on another thing. Tom, you know, we have in legislation now, we have this requirement to use the ecological regions and subregions. And I know you talked in your recommendations a little bit about the geographic considerations and so forth. Right. Anything you want to add on or suggestions you might, or guidelines you might want to offer to the council about marrying those regions with our constitutional obligations as well? Or maybe you don't have to answer that now, but I would hope that you could help us think that through.
I'd be delighted to. We work by ecoregion, as you know, Bob. Right. Nature Conservancy works by ecoregions and by landscape, so we do this all the time, and it's inconvenient because it crosses jurisdictions, but it makes much more sense from a land management standpoint. People are often talking about what we might manage by landscape or watershed or whatever. I don't think I can make arguments for either one, but ultimately it makes far more sense than county boundaries.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just to say, I think that there's a lot of value in having this language here. That, you know, as we reach out to potential recipients of the appropriation to reference that their proposals have to be consistent with these guidelines and these particular DNR plans and other things, I think is very helpful. And if folks can meet them, I think it saves us a lot of work.
Ellen? Well, I was just going to mention on the PILF issue that the governor's budget proposed a 20% cut to PILF, and it was extremely difficult when we had to cut all of our budgets to manage that. In the end, Representative Wagenius and I, who chaired that budget conference committee and put those budgets together, put zero cut to PILF, even though it was extremely difficult, and it meant shifting more costs to other areas of the budget, more cuts to other areas of the budget. And the argument was that as we move forward to acquire more land, if we start reducing PILT, we're just going to create more friction and more opposition. It's not to say that we shouldn't look at reform and long-term other ways of doing things, because I don't know if it's sustainable to keep going the way that we are, but There's a real tension there between the governor trying to reduce aid to local governments and those of us who really want to support more land acquisition. So those are some of the factors that have come into the discussion.
And the auditor will start what's called the scoping process, where there's public input meetings on how to do the audit, and I would encourage everybody to participate in those, because the more framing, the more input on how that process begins, the better it would be. So the interest groups, the citizens and people here need to engage in that process.
Tom, if I could just one follow-up to Melissa's statement about PILT. One of the counties that is known that gains Polk, but I can tell you right now, Polk loves us, and we have acquired 24,000 acres in Polk County that we're going to give the federal government. The reason they like us is because we recognized early on when we purchased the property, and both Bob and Darby remember this, in 1992, we purchased 24,000 acres, and we ultimately were going to give the Fish and Wildlife Service as a National Wildlife Refuge. Well, that's a township, a township of land changing hands. And one of the things you haven't perhaps recognized with respect to the federal revenue sharing, refuge revenue sharing, it doesn't pay the equivalent of property tax. It pays some rate less than that, and in fact, in many cases, it's less than the department's PILT payment. The county came to us and said, look, if you're going to cost us that much money, we're going to oppose this project rally. We said, here's what we'll do. We shall set up an endowment that will forever pay the difference between what the federal government pays you and what those property taxes would have been. And then we proceeded to accumulate an endowment by aggregating the lease income from the cropland on that property. So we use that property, as I was talking about before, to generate income, went into an endowment, setting up a pot in perpetuity now that will make up the difference between what the federal government is paying and what the property taxes would have been. The county says, hey, buy all you want. We're delighted. Now we have a tourist attraction in Polk County, and we didn't have one before. So point is not that that's the only model you have to follow, but that there are alternatives. PILT is sort of like drainage law. You don't even talk about opening it because people get nervous, but it is probably time to review it and see what it means.
Darby? Yeah. Just a quick question. How do you use the property to generate income? What's the
when we bought the Glacial Ridge, much of it was cropland. and we're slowly converting it into grassland. But in that interim, you know, we bought it in 2000, and we still got, I don't know, several thousand acres of corn ground on there. We're leasing that out to local farmers, so A, we're keeping the economy going there because we've got local farmers busy. But then we took all of that income, we committed to the county, we'll take all of the income, we'll put it into a pot, and it'll generate the tax revenue. So we still hold that endowment, but we've got a written agreement with the county, we'll give it, cut them a check every year.
Tom, thanks. Thanks for offering
us. Thank you very much.
Very helpful.
And again, congratulations.
Thank you. Susan, you can join us. Good. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Susan Schmidt. I'm state director for the Trust for Public Land. Thank you so much. I just want to start off by saying thank you for the opportunity to share some of our thoughts about the process. And I think that's what you wanted me to focus on. I do have notes for myself. Mr. Becker, if you'd like an inviting, I'd be glad to get them. But I think I will focus on the process, which is what your email said. And Ryan and Tom and I talked April 27th, or just short of that meeting, and of course a lot has happened since then. But we did have a good conversation, and I also had a good conversation with the folks who led, helped facilitate that fourth bucket with me. So it wasn't just me, it was a number of people, so thanks to many of them who were in the room. What worked? Your guidance document, thank you for your guidance document, having that in writing and having it as soon as you could get it to us was helpful. I'll talk about that in a minute. Involving stakeholders, obviously, and echoing what Tom just said, encouraging that, it really worked. It was helpful, some more specifics there, but also turning to the NGOs to ask help with information gathering was really helpful, I think, and worked as well. I do want to say that Bill was wonderful as a staff person in terms of helping us to sort through the definitions or lack thereof. And also, I want to say that the fourth bucket, if you will, and that's what we kind of refer to it as, the fourth bucket, which I'll talk about a little bit more in a minute in terms of definition, we also turned to the Department of Natural Resources. They offered to provide some staff help, and so we got some great help from Grant Wilson and Kathy Don Carlo. So I do want to say that. That worked. Being inclusive clearly worked, I think, at least I think in all the buckets, in the fourth bucket in particular, encouraging the use of all the plants, the great resource plants that already exist, that helped, that worked. And in the end, of course, the information gathered, I think by this collaborative process that you encouraged, helped you make decisions in the short period of time that you had. So, I mean, clearly that worked, and I do want to say that certainly some, you know, some of your recommendations in particular, I think, are excellent projects, and we as Minnesotans can be very proud of them. And the collective work that led us up to them, and thanks to the legislature for their endorsement of those recommendations. What didn't work so well? Clearly, the time was short. I would say that the definition issue, the fourth bucket in particular, is a confusing bucket. What does fish, game, and wildlife habitat mean? Most of us thought it meant aquatic habitat. Other people thought maybe it was lakes, rivers, and streams. That was never agreed to, and it was confusing. It was confusing for us who volunteered to facilitate, and it was certainly confusing to those that participated. And I will say, because of the timing and the kind of eclectic nature of that fourth bucket, everybody drove to the fourth bucket, so to speak. It was, you all saw the long list of people who were involved. Well, that is exactly why. I mean, we were very inclusive, but that is part of the reason why. We talked about it earlier, Tom and Ryan and I talked about this. The silos, if you will, that are created by the four buckets doesn't work very well. I mean, I would echo that we work in protecting land and water resources that have forest land resources and wetland resources. So where do they land? And that's clearly an issue. I will point out that I think there was a tension, if you will, between the criteria that you used, but we referred to it at the time as shovel-ready, and the encouragement that you made to think about programs. And as I watched and participated and observed and was a part of this, it just it was very, I think there was a tension between when a proposer put forward a program, which is by its nature, I think, a string of projects. But if a proposer put forward a project that was shovel-ready and urgent, if you will, for any number of reasons, there were a different level of questions for those two kinds of proposals. And so I'd encourage you to think about that, all of us to think about it and how to do that differently. I think there's clearly amongst the members a familiarity with certain groups and a lack of familiarity with other groups and other collaboratives. And I look forward to figuring out how to introduce and how to be a part of some of those collaboratives and partnerships that you might not all be familiar with as individuals or as a group. I will say that what didn't work so well, even though the written guidance was helpful and we appreciated that, what didn't work is, again, there was a lack of definition in some cases in that document. There was a number of criteria, but there were almost too many. I mean, I think this is what Tom was saying, some kind of scoring system or weighting system or prioritization of criteria would have been extremely helpful. And I know, given the short time frame, but as we look forward, prioritizing or weighting criteria. And obviously, the legislature is thinking through the framework and the guidance document will be extremely helpful with that thinking as well. The direction, I would point out that I think in your framework and as we move forward as that's fine-tuned, direction and thinking about some of the strategic issues, if you will, that were clearly, I think, front and center in the discussion both here and in the legislature subsequent. And I would just point out that we believe, and I think most of the folks that participated in the fourth bucket believe, that habitat that's critical for fish, game, and wildlife, but has limited access for hunting, is clearly important to the state. And where does it fit? Where does scientific and natural areas fit? You can hunt them sometimes. The commissioner has the discretion to determine when that is, certainly. But what about scientific and natural areas? What about parks, reserves, or habitat in the greater metropolitan area, which by its nature is close to people, and therefore limitation on hunting is clearly a part of habitat protection in that sense. So where does it fit? It doesn't fit in this bucket. What bucket, what, or fund, if you will, what fund does it fit in? And as you all have time, and we all have time to look at the whole bill, I think you'll find out that it doesn't really fit anywhere. And that needs to be addressed, I think, in the years, the months ahead, and I look forward to being a part of that. Clearly, the interrelationship between those four funds and the work of the LCCMR needs to be addressed in your framework and your thinking about what do you want to see in proposals and how will you be sorting through those so that when we all at the end see your recommendations as they go to the legislature, we can go, aha, I understand why. And that I hope will come as we all work with that. Now, again, I think what didn't work so well, I think, is that sifting through information on behalf of the LOHC, because of the volunteers in this room and many others, I'm not sure in the end impacted your decisions, because maybe it was the time frame or maybe it was that lack of frame, you know, the definition of the prioritization and the framework. But in the end, we couldn't always say, aha, I understand why. And so maybe in the years to come, we'll be able to see that more clearly. But, for example, in the fourth bucket, AMA, I mean, I've looked at it very closely because I was a part of all those meetings that led up to it. And the AMA Aquatic Management Area Program was funded, but, you know, there was clearly other things. There was a collaborative proposal that TPL, in all honesty, is a part of, the Metro Habitat Conservation Corridors Collaborative. But it wasn't considered as a whole, but a component of it was pulled out and funded. And, you know, so encouraging partnership, how do you do that? And I think hopefully the criteria will help, you know, as they're fine-tuned in the end. So in short, if I'm thinking about 2010 and I think about the things that work and the things that in our opinion, collect, and again, this is Susan Schmidt's words here, and people will have different opinions about this because we have limited time to think with collective mind. But I would say that strategic framework is going to be so helpful. And we look forward to being a part of it at this meeting and future meetings probably, and our partners do and the Trust for Hope plan does, looking more closely at definitions, at the criteria, at the weighting of criteria, some of those issues that do need to be strategically discussed. Habitat protection when hunting is not allowed all the time, but some of the time. Scientific and natural areas, habitat for parkland purposes, habitat in the metropolitan area, etc. Interrelationships between the four buckets, thinking along ecoregions, I think that's a great way to maybe get through a number of these things, and then obviously relying on the plans that exist. That's how I see the strategic framework, and I heard that a little bit earlier as well, very similar. Encourage collaboration. Obviously, I know you will do that. We will all do that. I'd encourage it in the proposal development and proposal making stage, and that thankfully you'll have staff now, if I'm reading the law correctly, to help you sort through the information in a fair way so that those of us in the room can focus on what we do best, which is proposal development, proposal making, collaborative, and getting the good work done. Working with you all, working with legislators, and working with staff. And then finally, I would offer, as I know many in this room, tours, opportunities to get out and be and get on the land that we're talking about. That sometimes when we're familiar with certain parts of the state, we don't know what those, what the habitat or the particular areas are that we're talking about. So we want to create those opportunities for not only this commission, but the folks in this room and the LCCMR members if they have an interest in legislators that obviously are involved in this arena. So I will stop there.
Thank you.
Say thank you.
Questions for Susan? Thoughts?
Bob? Mr. Chair, Susan, thanks for coming in. As you know, this is new for everybody. And so we're, in some respects, making it up as we went along. And we all had notions of how things get put together, and some of those were aligned and some were different, but none of them were necessarily bad. This council saw a number of proposals that had a lot of merit, but our judgment was that they might have been more properly funded through the parks and trails component, for example. I haven't followed, honestly, the details of what those appropriations were ultimately and so forth, but is it, and maybe you haven't either, but if you have, would you view that the decisions that the legislature made in that component was reasonable and appropriate for those things that we didn't fund, that we judged to be more closely aligned in that pot of funding source, if we're making sense.
You are making
Because I think that your recommendations are very helpful to us, but I think that there's probably some carry forward of those similar types of things for the legislature's consideration of the other, of that particular other component of the funding.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Mr. Schroeder, members of the council, first of all, that's why I emphasized hopefully several times that in your framework, and obviously as the legislature thinks about the, I forgot the word, is it a guideline?
Guidance.
Thinking about the interrelationship between those four funds, I think it's just going to be critical. But this is my opinion. We did track the Parks and Trails bucket very closely. There's some excellent things, again, in there. But I don't think... land protection of land and water for park inholdings or a new park is a part of it necessarily. I think it will sometime, but this year perhaps I think if others were here with me, I would say that there's a pent-up need, if you will, to take care of what we have. And so there's perhaps more of a focus there than on protecting land and water for parkland, protecting habitat, if you will, for parkland.
Mr. Chair, then, Susan, a similar question on the water side. You know, we saw a number of proposals that we thought, well, that's really good. It sounds like it's great, but it might be better funded through the Clean Water Fund.
Yes. We did track the water fund. I am not an expert in water cleanup, but Mr. Chair, I would say it's excellent work. I mean, it's a focus on cleanup, and I think we all need to focus on cleanup of impaired waters. At the Trust for Public Land, we personally believe that we need to also look at prevention and look at more carefully look at protecting some of our more pristine waters in a balanced way. So another one of those areas where we need to strike a balance, whether it's this year, I don't think it necessarily was, but hopefully in the years to come it will be.
Any other questions for Susan? Again, thank you, and thanks again for your help in leading that fourth bucket, which was a pretty tough one. I know that, as you said, a lot of people were attracted to that one simply because it was very all-encompassing.
The last door.
Gene, you were part of that. I'd like, if you don't mind, just come up and offer a few comments from your perspective before Ryan, just to kind of follow up on that.
Ryan's going out for water. I'll be quick.
Clean water.
Thank you all very much, Jane Prohaska with the Minnesota Land Trust, and we did provide a few written comments which are in front of you. We did help the Trust for Public Lands. Chris Larson of my staff worked with Susan to convene the Habitat group, the fourth group, and as I believe you know, we also submitted proposals in each of the categories. So we did have quite a bit of involvement in the entire process. my comments will echo very much what Tom and Susan have already said. First of all, we were honored to be included and are certainly thrilled to have a proposal that was funded, and we thank you for that. The comments that we have here sound much more critical than we think the process went, because given the time period, we were very much impressed with the thoughtfulness, professionalism, and the efficiency of the way in which things work in order to get those proposals in front of the legislature. The comments we'll make are just very specific about both the any collaborative process you might choose. We've already talked about the use of having the prairie forest, wetlands, and habitat different silos or buckets, whatever you want to call them. I think we all uniformly agree that doesn't work very well. That may have already been hammered out in the new legislation, so we don't need to go into it. But among other things, what wasn't clear in that that may not have been brought up is, was it intended that your projects be compared to other forest projects, or are forest projects be compared to wetlands projects, or how, whatever process that you end up choosing in the future, whatever criteria, a little bit more clarification on some of those kinds of things going forward. But a couple of comments I want to make specifically about collaborative process. We volunteered. We got the call, but we did volunteer. I want to be clear about that. But it became a very time-consuming process for those of us who did this. And I think to the extent you want a collaborative process, it was an excellent way to find out what everybody else was doing out there. And for some of us, we worked together in other collaboratives, in other situations not so much. And in that sense, I think having some kind of a collaborative process could be an excellent way of getting the parties who are working on the ground to talk to each other a little bit more than we might on a daily basis. On the other hand, it needs to be clearer what the point of the process is. Did you really want us to screen proposals, evaluate proposals, rank proposals? There was some direction, but it really wasn't clear if that was the role of the group, and especially the role of the convener, which, of course, became a little bit of a conflict from, or at least an appearance of conflict from time to time, depending on that role. But I think by changing the nature of who does the convening, you might be able to get at some of the other benefits of having a collaborative process. I also think the outreach really went well, not perfect, but well. All the statewide organizations knew what was going on, state government, federal government. It is at the local level that I think we can do even more to reach those local units of government. And we can do that just by having more time in the future, working with the associations, whether it's Association of Counties, Association of Cities, Association of Townships, Watershed Districts, by bringing them into the process or giving them information, they can choose whether to participate or not at that level. Usefulness. I think you need to tell us whether this was a useful process to have some sort of a collaborative kind of review project. Certainly we brought you consistency in terms of the way in which the projects were set up and presented. I'm not sure if that information really was of value to you, and we would love to hear that in response. Were our efforts of value or not? I do think also for some of the participants, it wasn't clear if being a member of a collaborative process helped or perhaps put you a bit at a disadvantage. As Susan mentioned, some of the collaboratives within collaboratives kind of got lost in the bigger picture. Not intentionally. I think it was an unintended consequence, but certainly something to think about as you think about going forward from here. And finally, in terms of future efforts, I do think criteria, some of those now are set in statute and some will continue to evolve as you do this. Having that clearer and up front will provide you with better proposals because we can self-screen. I'm not sure if, like Tom, I would go for the full point system because there are a lot of other things in play here, including an entire legislative process in addition to a process here that we want to be ever mindful of, that a point system like they use in NACA has its pluses and minuses, but it's also a very narrow program with a very narrow set of objectives. So you want to be very thoughtful about going to a full point process, I think, but I do think having criteria and being clear whether they're intended to be evaluative criteria or prioritization criteria would be very helpful as we think about even how to screen ourselves better so that we don't give you proposals that you're really not looking for. I do think that multi-year proposals, as has been mentioned, would be fabulous, and I think that will help build capacity, build program, And while I think urgency should be a part of this, I know this year urgency played a greater role than I think perhaps it might as in terms of going forward, where you can really be looking at organizations who can deliver over the long haul and provide those enduring benefits for the state. So I think that will be a bit of a balance I would like to think you take into account in funding future projects and programs. Not for lack of accountability, but specific results, specific things done on the ground, but how to get that programmatic approach so that you can have a long-term impact with one grant request, perhaps. I think it'll also be more efficient for you as you think about grants in the future and build that capacity that we need to get things done on the ground. Finally, one last thing that I mentioned to several of you earlier, I think there are great opportunities coming up this summer and in the fall to just get information out about whatever process or criteria you use. Website I know that's underway will be one, but that requires an affirmative action on the recipient's to go get it. But there are lots of conferences out there, like the Minnesota Land Trust will be hosting one with the University of Minnesota Arboretum and the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District. There's maybe a track for where there's just a practical how to apply kind of session. What are the rules so you don't come in with projects that don't meet the rules? NACA does this all the time. I think it would be a good use of staff time to address multiple parties in that kind of a session. And I know you've all been out in the past, sometimes more listening, but this would be a great opportunity for you to now say, this is how it works. And you can get some feedback, but also get the information out there in ways that the practitioners can then put it to work so you get better proposals. Thank you again. Very much appreciative of being in the process and are very much willing and wanting to work with you on details of this as you go forward.
Thanks, Jane. Questions?
Jane, in response to your question, was your input helpful? Extremely helpful. I had the opportunity of working with Henry Van Hoffman in Detroit Lakes, and Henry's vision coming up for the Red River project from Lake Traverse to Kitson County, I think, is extremely interested in. I think it will, if it comes to fruition, will make an enormous impact in the state of Minnesota and give us the opportunity to work with North Dakota.
Yeah, I was just going to say, of course, I agree with Les. It was very helpful, not just for you, Dave, but for all the others, and for a lot of reasons, but not the least of which is that, you know, we're organized under state law, and for us to have had those collaboratives, we probably would still be doing them right now. So you guys are able to do things and set a framework for folks in a way that I think got us much further down the road in a much faster way and much more organized than we could otherwise have done on our own. Let me ask you specifically this. It's not too many months now between now and when our next recommendations are due, January 15th. So I think on an operational basis, planning, you know, we've probably got to be done by December. The end of December for our recommendations. And we've got, you know, a lot of obligations that we need to consider putting things forward. From your view, when do you think we need to be on the street with that outreach?
September.
Okay.
I think that would give adequate time for good proposal preparation. And good collaboration if you really want people to work together rather than just gather and exchange information. October gets a little, well, you get the sacred month of October and you're all out hunting. So we're kind of losing ground there. So that would be mine.
Okay. Well, that's consistent with my thought as well. That by that point, by the start of, after Labor Day, we need to know what those priorities are and where we want to go with our recommendations.
Mr. Chair, Jane, one question.
Sure.
When we were having all the input and everybody came in, we gave you your 3 minutes, basically. I felt really bad for all of you. I thought we ran you all up here for how many hours and gave you 3 minutes to tell you what's on the line. Is there a better way that we can do that so that you feel like you got your 2 cents worth and we get all the information we should get?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's an excellent point. I think the decision about whether you want to hear every proposal or whether there might be a first cut, the role of staff versus the whole council, I think, is something you'll want to discuss. Maybe there's a way to, because I do think we want to continue outreach to not limit proposals, but I think your time as well as our time is better spent on hearing those proposals that are most more likely to meet the criteria and be funded. So you may not want to hear everyone for 3 minutes, but maybe hear a smaller number for a longer period of time. That would be my take about what would be most useful.
Good point. Thank you.
Yeah, one other quick question. Mr. Chair, Jane, I, in talking with the different people too associated with the different projects, it would help, and I've done this with Ryan, with Henry, what is your priority? And what are your best projects in rating them and ranking them? And the reasons, and then we can go into it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that's an excellent point because the criteria require us to have a screening process internally even to be a participant with this funding, and we all have it, and you may or may not know what that is and how we would take a string of projects and bring them forward. I think also going back a little bit in terms of presentation, if we knew what questions you wanted answered most, it might help both sides and how to do a presentation. We always know what we want you to hear about us, which may or may not be what you want, you know, what are your questions. And so to that extent, it might get at the same issues of how we prioritize or what are the pieces of information that would help you distinguish between a range of good projects, because we know that a lot of good projects got left on the table, and that doesn't mean they aren't good, but what would have helped more in terms of deciding between those things.
Thanks, Jane. I really appreciate it. Again, thanks for all your help with that collaborative. Yeah.
Thank you.
Ryan. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon.
Good to be here. I would echo the comments from others that you all deserve a great round of applause and appreciation for the many hours from December 1 to today and ongoing into the future. My name is Ryan Heiniger. I'm the Director of Conservation Programs for Ducks Unlimited in Minnesota and Iowa. Because of the collaboration between the collaborators, I'll be a little bit more brief. We did touch base earlier and have many of the same general comments and principles. I'm handing out a few things that I'll touch on here in a moment. But, you know, considering that you went from December 1st to the 12th of January to establish a framework, I think that was a wonderful start and really gave us as the collaborative leaders a remarkable place to start with the discussions and try to get at the tough questions of who's eligible and how can we all work together to put together a package. One thing I'm really proud about as far as the wetland collaborative goes is I think we were the only group to actually come forth with a primary recommendation of a single program. Everybody put their own turf and their programs and organizations aside in the interest of what was the most urgent, what had the most biological benefit, and what was the most needed out there in the landscape. And that recommendation, as you recall, was the Reinvest in Minnesota WRP Partnerships Program. With the compressed schedule that everyone was dealing with, I think the Habitat Collaborative process was a necessary one. But I would again concur with Susan and Tom that in the future there's probably a different model to draw from, given that folks will have a longer amount of time to put together proposals. And hopefully, I think by September, my comment on that, Mr. Chair, is that even if you could have it sooner than that, in terms of just having it out there on the streets for publicity and for people to get aware of it, I think the sooner the better would be our recommendation on that specific aspect. You know, as far as the collaboratives go, we did have experience working with one another in many cases. My own philosophy is that I think partnerships in general are best left to spontaneous combustion, if you will, that people will come together, groups, individuals, organizations, agencies will come together because of a common denominator. And it might not just be a singular habitat type like wetlands or prairies. There might be other aspects like geography that people are just really most interested in. And so that might be one consideration. Similarly, to put each habitat type that's listed in the Constitution as a box or a bucket, if you will, I think misses some of the components that have been talked about earlier, and that is that what we're really doing is landscape conservation work at an ecosystem level, and certainly in the case of wetlands and their long-term health and viability, they have to be embedded in grasslands and prairie and in forest to be productive for the long haul. And so to that end, just something to think about, I put together that three-dimensional matrix of how the elements in the Constitution may all fit together and how proposals could be both organized and potentially judged with or without a specific objective scoring system. So on the right side with fish, game, and wildlife, as I understand the wording, that could be sub-levels or tiers within wetlands, prairies, forests, and then, of course, the conservation actions that I think we're all familiar with in terms of implementing work on the ground, the actions to restore, protect, and enhance. So that would be one of the key recommendations that I would offer, is to look maybe at a different model that isn't necessarily a four-bucket model. With respect to programs that the council has a long-term vested interest in funding, there may be value in looking at how the council can go about making longer-term commitments, realizing there are certain limitations in terms of finding future legislative actions and so forth, and not knowing what future revenue streams may consist of. The other handout that Mr. Knopf passed out is an example of how the Nebraska Environmental Trust, which is actually funded by lottery dollars, but very similar in respect to the citizen legislative council, and they have a long-term landscape approach whereby they will only fund projects 1 year at a time, but they will give an intent of years two and years three so that the individual grantee or prospective grantee can better plan looking at other funding sources if they're not selected, or just maybe plan out a few more years so you can not necessarily feel rushed that you have to get the projects done in 1 year and then somehow have to scramble and get back to the table in subsequent years. So I don't know what the possibilities are for doing something similar in Minnesota, but that might be one other consideration. You'll note there on the left side of that specific ranking sheet that they also use a numeric score, and they just essentially, as I understand it, fund from the highest ranked score that all the members get compiled, and then when they're out of money, that's the last program or project to get funded. So with that, I would certainly stand for any questions, but thanks again for all your work.
Questions for Ryan?
Scott? One of the questions I have for you, Ryan, is when we were listening to proposals, and we listened to hundreds of proposals, and many of them, I mean, there were many great proposals that didn't get funded, and some of the proposals that did get funded got funded something less than what they'd asked for. If we had made a soft commitment on all of those really good projects, okay, to fund in years two or three, and we do that for two or three years, assuming that proposals in year two that come to us will need multiple year funding, what do I say to my guy down in Worthington, Minnesota, when he says, you know, you're 3 years into the process and you're funding multiple year proposals and $50 million of your $70 million is already spent? How do I respond to that person?
Right.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Rawl. An excellent challenge that would put in front of you. One scenario might be to limit the extent to which you would make commitments in years two or three so that there still is a majority of the funding base left to be allocated as new things arise, urgencies and opportunities come forth. So that might be one way to handle it. But again, I think it comes back to also the working in large blocks so that hopefully an individual in Worthington feels just as part of something greater that's happening, and it might not be right there that specific year, but they feel it, they see it locally when they're out driving around. They know that the investments are having the impact that are desired.
Wes? Mr. Chair, Brian, one of the comments to turn a negative into a positive that was brought up in one of the committee hearings, and I don't exactly recall on what date, but whether the council may be negatively influenced by our association with organizations like Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Deer Hunters, not negatively influenced, but very, very positively influenced.
because of the work that Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Deer Hunters, and many of the other wildlife agencies in the state of Minnesota have performed for us. 86 cents out of every dollar raised by Ducks Unlimited goes back into the environment. You're a very efficient organization and have done a remarkable job. And therefore, we're going to listen to your recommendations. We're going to ask you to prioritize, and we're going to use some very positive influence that you will present in the council. And I know Scott's heavily involved with Pheasants Forever, myself at DU, Wayne with the Deer Hunters, and they're great organizations, and it's a great staff of people that you have in your regional biologists, from Matt Holland to John Schneider, that have given us very, very good scientific backed data that we can use to make a good decision. So thank you to you.
Brian?
Maybe one other comment, unless you wanted me to respond something specifically in there, Les.
Not really.
Okay. Mr. Enger asked a question about the presentations and if folks felt rushed. We all probably get put in front of too many PowerPoint presentations, but I'm certainly a very visual person, so when I get to see pictures of what projects look like before or after, whatever facilities in the future may allow for that, I think that would be one small but beneficial consideration. Another element may be to consider the proposals that are ranked highly among all council members, to put them in one category, but then a subset that are on the bubble, so to speak, to have those grantees or prospective grantees come in and give a more elaborate, more in-depth discussion so that there's a greater knowledge base. Hopefully some of the questions that maybe led to a lower scoring can be answered directly. Something to think about.
Any other comments? Darby?
Yeah, this is a question. I'm wondering to what degree you think we ought to try to sort of guide the type of projects, maybe in an RFP, say, okay, this year we're out of balance maybe in this area or that area. Is that something that you'd recommend or react to?
Mr. Chair and members, the idea of looking at the different landscapes or ecosystems throughout the state and then what kind of a formula or equitable distribution of funds over time may be considered, that's a tough one, because I don't think it's just a level playing field because of cost of doing business, needs, threats, and so forth. Perhaps one missing item out there statewide is a more comprehensive database or an assessment, if you will, that looks at the state and where all the dollars are going, realizing that the new Outdoor Heritage Fund is going to be a major infusion, but there are other expenditures happening outside of the Lasada Council because of the NGOs that are at work, certainly the DNR and other state agencies and federal agencies. And so to try to get a feel for how others are impacting landscapes, I think, would be important. I don't know if that necessarily gets at your specific question.
Well, I was really concerned, I guess, about the fact that maybe if things just come in sort of randomly, basically, you could very well end up with a lot more projects in one area and darn few in another. I mean, maybe, we see prairie lands just not getting the attention, and not that anybody would. That's really what I was concerned about.
Mr. Chair and members, to me what that begs the question is how does the council want to approach projects with respect to the portion of investment that you're willing to offer up from the Outdoor Heritage Fund relative to what others are putting forth? So, in other words, there may be a project in Redwood County and there's no partners, but for whatever reason it's just a great project, so you would maybe have to bear 90 or 95 or 100% of the cost. Is that worth it because no one else is willing to take it on for whatever reason? I think that would hopefully raise the question, why is nobody else interested, but nonetheless would be a consideration that if you felt strongly because of the ecological benefits, the value for prairies or fish game and wildlife that project represented, then probably worth going after.
One other quick comment, Mr. Chair, Ryan. One of the things, too, that we've talked about extensively in the council is the planting of funding. We have to make sure that DU, because they don't see this pot of money in Minnesota coming, that you're going to supplant to the other states also. So make sure you keep your level up there.
Mr. Chair, members, we'll go on the record as saying we are doing everything and anything possible. Granted, the times are tough on NGOs, just like individuals, families, and businesses are right now in the fundraising world, but we are aggressively pursuing private match, whether it's from foundations, corporations, individuals, major donors, to bring to the table to further leverage funds and to ultimately do more work, because that's the issue, is that there just has not been enough investments in wetlands and shallow lakes, and to turn the corner, we're going to have to ramp that effort up. So you have my firm commitment on that.
Rick?
Ryan, do you think there'd be a value in bringing in some maybe non-traditional folks like the assessors or the appraisers or county recorders or county treasurers that are having some on-the-ground knowledge of what's really happening with land values and the consequences thereof? Because, you know, 3 or 4 months ago, we were hearing land's cheap, it's going down, now it's time to buy. I heard of one sale of ag land yesterday of over $5,000 an acre. So the rate of the incentives for conversion are very high, and I think that the values are continuing to go up in some cases rather than going down. And so as we make decisions based on fee or easement or value or location, it's a very dynamic, I think, there's probably a very dynamic reality going on out there. And you're seeing it, and I'm sure Tom has seen that as well, when you're actually trying to close a deal on property. And so in the next few months, is that sort of a background type of thing that we should be looking at to give us some baseline when we start making some of these decisions?
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, I'll confess I'm a biologist by training, and so the aspect of land valuation and trends, that's an area that certainly there are other experts throughout the state, whether it's the local assessor or an economic professor at the U or whatever the situation is. Anytime you can factor in economics and try to be out front on the deal, I think the better off we'll be. One element that I considered putting together with this matrix was a fourth dimension, which was an economic component of cost of doing business. I think that speaks to some of what you're asking about. I guess the last thing I would mention is that the worst time to be doing land deals is when the bulldozer is imminent in terms of the habitat destruction. And so what we may even perceive as expensive today as, you know, $5,000 acquisitions or easements may just be the bargain of the future.
Well, we know that we have a very limited pool of prairie that's out there, and we don't have sod saver. It's not happening, even though we've tried to do something there. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there's been any general sign-up of CRP announced at a broad level recently. So we have a strong incentive for conversion that puts a very limited pool of native prairie at risk. And so prioritizing there and trying to at least protect that or restore that or identify that would be, I think, something that would be valuable. But I'd like your feedback on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson and members, I'm a big fan of native prairie. It's sad that our state only has 90,000 acres left of unprotected and 180,000 total, as Tom alluded to. The first question I would ask is, what is the ecological condition of the existing prairie? Just because it may have been unbroken, does it still offer currently the value, or does it have future probability of having a diverse species mix in the future? Easements, I think, are going to be a key element to perhaps locking up some of those last remaining vestiges of native prairie where landowners do not want to sell. It's not available for fee title acquisition.
We have to be competitive. And it is frustrating and disappointing that we do not have a side saver provision right now in Minnesota, as none of the other pretty foul states do.
Any other comments? Okay, Ryan, again, this was all the collaborative leaders. Thank you, and thanks for your comments. These are helpful. What we want to do now is, are there any other individuals who want to provide some comments to the council? Again, reflecting back on the process we went through to get to the point where we're at, and some advice as we move forward. If so, please if you could limit your comments to just a couple minutes, but please come forward. And if you could remind who you are.
Yep, Mr. Chairman, members of the council, my name is Greg Qualley. And I'm sorry I didn't reserve a spot on the agenda today, but I just decided to come down today. A couple things caught my attention here. I'm going to use this matrix that Ryan listed. And one thing I'd like to encourage the council to do is include lakes in this. And I know there's a portion of the council or of the heritage funds that deal specifically with clean water. I think right at this particular point in time, from my limited experience with the council and with the projects that have been funded this year, there is a dire need to start thinking about the 12,000 lakes we have and what happens beneath the surface of the water. I'm coming down here as a representative of Anglers for Habitats, a new organization. We're an alliance of anglers that are dedicated to the improvement and protection of aquatic habitat, clean water, and fishing. So those are our interests. We're trying to pull together a pretty broad, disjointed group of species-specific angling interest, and we'd like you folks to give some more consideration to aquatic issues, in particular how we get work done below the water. It's a completely different set of rules apply there. I think, as you know, you're very focused right now on the terrestrial part of fish and game habitat and wildlife in Minnesota. I think you need to broaden your scope a little bit. I think you need to look below the surface of the water. How do we put projects in these lakes, on lakeshore, that's going to protect the lakeshore, it's going to protect the fishing habitat? We don't know much about it. You've heard from all the terrestrial groups. That's where I came from originally. I've migrated to the water. My interest is below the surface of the water right now and in that riparian habitat around it, and that's what Anglers for Habitat is all about. One other thing, a suggestion, I guess, to the council, and I know this is not new, but take your meetings out state once in a while. I really think you'd get a good grip on what's going on. You'd be able to get at those constituents that you were talking about down in Worthington, perhaps. Give them an opportunity to come in. So I guess those are my comments. And Representative Hansen, I would encourage you to seek the counsel of both the local officials that are dealing with property values and the professional real estate appraisers. I happen to be one. I gave my card to Mike a while back. I am an appraiser in the state of Minnesota. I would be happy to consult on a pro bono basis with the council if that's appropriate. I know the easement process, I know the fee acquisition process, and I do work in about the northern two-thirds of the state, and that's not a promotion for my business. That's an offer to help you understand real estate issues and particularly land valuation techniques and how that whole process works. So,
great. Well, thank you. Thanks for your comments. Any questions? Darby and then Scott.
I guess I've really got just a question for you, and that is when we do these travels to various locations, are we planning to incorporate public listening sessions as a part of that? I certainly hope we are.
So members, great question. My intent is our traveling that involves 2 days. Obviously, we'll spend the daytime in the field, but my intent is we would have either a business meeting or a business meeting and or, you know, a public comment forum. I mean, obviously, we want to receive comments. I've heard that from many people. You know, people from Hublin, Minnesota yesterday contacted me and said, when are you coming up to my neck of the woods? So we hear that from not only Worthington, but kind of the exact opposite of the state. But yes, my intent is that some component of our field trips will include a council meeting where the public certainly can provide us input, just as
we're getting today. Scott?
One of the questions I have for you is, the council obviously funded aquatic management areas with multiple $1 million. You know, that was
correct.
Kind of our movement towards aquatic-type habitats. If your organization, the young organization, is this, you're talking about projects under the water surface, can you give me an idea of what or one or two of those type projects might be? You know, our Wetland Act work and our RIMWRP work is obviously clean water, which ultimately ends up in lakes, but what kind of projects up under the water?
I would say shoreline restoration is probably one of the major ones where there's been some serious impact to a shoreline, where the vegetation in the littoral area has basically been destroyed. And that's really the heart of the fishery right there, especially for brood rearing and stuff like that. But I guess shoreline restoration would be one. And I'd encourage you to take a look way out on the edges on some of this stuff. We've got good land protection options out there. We've got conservation easements that run from A to Z. We've got fee title acquisition. We really don't have a tool that allows us to do protection below the surface of the water. Now, there's some legal issues there, but it might bear some exploration. There might be some sort of a study there where we could, where we could gain some valuable legal information and also some habitat type of information where there might be some tools that the council and the state of Minnesota could use to kind of, either protect or restore some of these areas with public dollars or with in-kind matching dollars. It's a completely new area. Everybody's afraid of it because of the public water rights and what you can do with the riparian edge and the permitting process. So I think there's some real opportunities there to maybe find some new tools to do good conservation work.
Thanks,
Mr. Chair. A quick comment. The DNR has published a shoreline management standard, which is an excellent standard, and it's received high opposition from the local units of government, primarily the county planning commissions. And I think the reason is because of the real estate development infringement on the rights to do what they want with the shoreline. I think those two have to be brought together to some reasonable form.
Wes, if I may, just briefly, I've done appraisal work in probably the northern two-thirds of the state of Minnesota, and the differences between the counties and the county planning and zoning offices and their ordinances are absolutely radical. One county, you can do just about anything you want. The next county, you have to have a permit to camp on the property for more than 2 weeks. On lakeshore property. So there's that's a local unit of government issue there, but there's just a wide range of different local issues there, and where the people want to protect the property and they want to protect the watersheds, they're doing it. Where they would rather have somewhat unlimited development, they're approaching it in that fashion, I would say. So, my opinion.
A couple things, and if I could get your card, not for an appraisal, but just to send you a couple things. One, in the clean water portion of the bill, we did put more money in the conference committee, but we put money in for shoreline restoration. So there's more money that came out than what went in. Mm-hmm. And so, and through the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the clean water portion has $13 million more dollars sent to the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Was in the House bill at the beginning. So a lot of the work that was done, not done just in the Outdoor Heritage, but Senator Anderson, Representative Genius, and I worked on these areas of the bill, and there are complementary issues that are there in the Clean Water Fund. On another bill that went through, the one tax bill that was signed, there is a provision for riparian buffers. There's a bill that I put in to try to protect those areas along Lakeshore with tax benefits. And as with many new concepts, that got turned into a study that would be going on. And that is law, and that has to, the drainage work group that is established is going to be looking at that, and I can get you the information on that particular piece of legislation. And then finally, we did pass in the law a provision that says that if you are going to get beneficial tax treatment through Green Acres, you have to comply with environmental and agricultural laws so that you have some consequence that takes the sod saver concept and puts it into statute. And that has some precedent.
Ellen?
Mr. Chair, just briefly, just want to comment on what you said about the conservation land, tax credit, or whatever it is, whatever format your study is. I just wanted to mention that that's an issue that we've been working on. A number of people have worked on for a number of years. And so, yes, it's a new issue, but it's taken a long time to even get a study. I'm glad to hear the study made it. Just a comment, Senator Stella Sams was the author of a bill that did that I was co-author of a number of years ago. So that's a policy change that's long, long overdue, and I hope we can get it done. Mr. Chair, I was going to mention, and it's appropriate with Mr. Qualley's testimony, I hope members will read the letter from NCEA that's in front of you too, since I don't think they're here to testify. And Henry Van Offelen really raises some good points about aquatic habitat as well, and I think we need to take that into consideration. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg. Thank you. Any other individuals? Kevin, I know you had just wrap it up. And again, just being mindful that we are running a bit late, Kevin. I don't want to steal your time, but
thank you, Mr. Chair, Council. I just want to give a brief update on the work and the great work the council's already done, pending hopefully the approvals of the bills that have been passed by the legislature. But specifically to the RIM-WRP partnership, based on the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council recommendation of the new Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, the Bowser Board approved a Phase 2 RIM-WRP sign-up, which began April 20th and runs through June 5th. As well, our partner in crime, one of our partners in crime, Natural Resources Conservation Service in Minnesota, state conservationist Bill Hunt, requested $22 million from Washington for leveraging those new funds based on your recommendations. And that's obviously very, very great news. We're in the sign-up process now. Soil and Water Conservation District, EUWRP contractors, and others are out there soliciting projects from landowners presently, and we're very, very pleased with what's occurring so far. We certainly expect that we'll have more than enough applications to fulfill the funds that we have available. I guess if some additional comments that I would make to the council, and I spoke to this earlier, but is maybe a reiterate this, I think the council, I would suggest that we look hard at how we can leverage other federal program opportunities for Minnesota. And RIM-WRP is just one example of that, where we can look at leveraging huge amounts of federal dollars if we make appropriate, have appropriations that we can leverage with those federal dollars and continue to, across many instances, particularly I think we could focus on the prairie wetland restoration component of the Northern Tallgrass Prairie and the Prairie Pothole Joint Venture area. Wetland projects, you know, when we talk about wetland restoration, we're really talking about wetland complexes. You're not doing just restoring the drained wetland. You're restoring native grasses, native grass communities around that. Multiple benefits occur from wildlife habitat and the number of species and associated with that. And so you're getting multiple benefits of that. In addition, there was some question about, you know, and certainly the rightful concern about some planting. Just so you know, the bonding bill was passed. The RIM program did receive a $500,000 appropriation for leveraging additional federal dollars, $500,000 recommendation, and we received another $500,000 recommendation to look at leveraging easements up in the Red River flooding scenario. So we continue that and those components. But again, I think, you know, not all programs are equal. Some programs have a long standard of success and proven delivery. That's not to say we don't look at enhancing and creating new things. I think lastly, what I would suggest to the council too is, as we go about this work, sustaining this level of effort for the next 24 years, technical capacity is going to have to be increased. We cannot, you know, you have a little adrenaline, you can go for a few years, you can accomplish a lot of this work, but if we're going to sustain this effort across all the new funds, not just the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council, having that technical capacity has to be a key ingredient into the council's thought process, ensuring that we have the folks that can work with the local landowners, do the projects, get the contractors out on the site, and complete the project. So with that, any questions? And if we can adjourn when you're ready.
Thanks, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Okay. Anyone else? Hmm?
Just a quick
question. I have one. Apparently, I missed one additional comment I just made. That, in fact, tonight we're finalists for an award from the Minnesota Environmental Initiative, the RIM WRP Partnership. We're going to be down. We're one of the finalists in the project partner category. We'll see how we do with that. But again, it's really taking that opportunity, a local, state, federal partnership. That's what the RIM WRP Partnership is about, and having that capacity and delivering. And I think, as Tom Landwehr alluded to earlier, too, local involvement is critical, and I think that's one of the reasons the RIM program is hugely successful. We have that commonality and trust with both the USDA service centers and the Stormwater Conservation District offices co-located. Landowners come in, they get all their answers. And if they don't get the answer at the moment, they know where they can reach for that resource to get the answer. So,
Wes, do you have a
question? Yes, Mr. Chair, Kevin. Have you targeted the major watersheds like you did several years ago with the Minnesota River, like Pond du Terre? Are you systematically going to be addressing the application of the RIM WRP to particular watersheds?
Mr. Chair, Council Member Bench, the specific Phase 2 application of the RIM WRP does not focus on a specific watershed. It focuses on the ecological subsections of the state, primarily what's considered the Northern Tallgrass Prairie and the Prairie Pothole Joint Venture Area of Minnesota, which I might add are two national priority areas for the state in various other conservation activities. So we're focusing in on that. We've in the past been very successful focusing watersheds such as the Minnesota River CREP back in the late 90s and early 2000 period. CREP 2, we looked at focusing three different watersheds that were not in the Minnesota River watershed. We have that capacity, certainly, and have the ability to do that. But with the council's recommendation, we looked at primarily looking at what were the benefits to achieve for primarily the prairie and wetland complexes through the RIM WRP sign-up.
Thank you. We need to move on, and again, I'm mindful we're going to be running a bit over on our schedule, but we asked Dean Coleman and Steve Hopps to just spend a few minutes with us and talk about, as we look forward in developing a strategic plan, and then the council will engage in a discussion afterwards about how we're going to proceed, but I think this is an important stage to set about kind of some ideas. Both of you have been involved in various statewide strategic planning efforts. For different purposes, but largely for the purpose of conservation and environmental issues in the state. So I'm going to turn it over to you for a few minutes, just if you would share some of the thoughts you have and some wisdom you might offer to us about, as we proceed forward, what we should be thinking about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. It's a pleasure to be here. Again, I'm Steve Hodges. I'm the director for the Bell and Conservancy. Gene Coleman from Sierra Planning. And before I begin, I do want to congratulate you guys on doing a great job. I think I've been involved in a number of statewide programs throughout the country, and the first year is always very, very difficult. And I think you did a tremendous job in sorting through all you had to sort through in a very truncated period of time. So what I want to talk about today is just a little bit about the 50-year vision that I worked on, as well as what Gene really orchestrated the statewide conservation and preservation plan. Talk about those two plans, how they might be integrated, and how they might assist you folks in developing your own strategic plan. Just to refresh your memory, the 50-year vision, I think you've all seen this. Essentially what it was, it started off with just myself and Steve Chaplin going through every plan we can find in the state of Minnesota, conservation plan, and reading those plans. Back in 2006, it was 60 or 70 plans that we went through. And also looking at watershed district plans, anything we get our hands on, and try to integrate all those plans into some kind of common vision. Then the next thing we did is to take what we had in terms of an integrated product and go out into 14 different areas that more or less line up with DNR's subsections. And then to vet those plans that we had and the visions that we had with some of the folks out there. So we had 30 different meetings, 300 different participants to all bring all this together that became the 50-year vision. And what this is that you've all read is the executive summary. If you want more information, it's actually on our website, bowen.org. Everything that's behind this executive summary, which is lots and lots of information, is there for you to read, and it's divided into each of these subsections. So I think that, again, should jive nicely with what you guys are looking at perhaps going forward in terms of trying to figure out different targets for conservation in different geographic areas. And I think that's really the next step, is to try to take all this information and distill it down in a way that people can use it on the ground, and people can develop proposals, present to the council, and in a way that as we roll these things up, it presents a common vision for conservation in Minnesota. And I'll pass it on to Gene to talk a little bit about how we can integrate those two things.
Great. Thank you, Steve. Gene?
Great. And I'm Gene Coleman. I was the project coordinator for the statewide conservation and preservation plan. Thank you for inviting me here today. I have some very brief, pointed comments about how the statewide plan could be used in your strategic planning process as you go forward, both for 2011, but also longer term and the 25-year strategic plan that the legislation is asking for. That particular point is the database that we created for the statewide conservation and preservation plan, and I've handed out my talking points with a visual that you've seen before regarding that database. The statewide plan, as Steve said, integrated lots of plans from around the state. We have recommendations. You may be familiar with those, but you may not be as familiar with the powerful database that we did create. We used both terrestrial and aquatic data from many sources, some of which I've listed here in my handout. We also looked at some of the threats, and they correspond with some of the items that have been mentioned here today regarding opportunities, where we should target opportunities, both from a habitat perspective, but also from a threat perspective. So what I would suggest is that you take advantage both of the visioning work that the 50-year vision created and the priority setting ability of the databases from the statewide plan in your strategic planning as you go forward. Some of the opportunities are to use those databases for modeling, restoration, protection, enhancement, and priorities within those, modeling at various scales in the state. The data is all at 30-meter resolution or finer and can be, therefore, scaled from a site level to a watershed level, to a county level, political boundaries, to ecological sections and subsections, and, of course, statewide. There is a potential use of this database by applicants that I see could be very beneficial to the process. There is an interface that's being created that should roll out this summer that will allow anyone to access and ask questions of all of the databases that we collected. And questions such as, does my particular parcel have species of biological significance? Is it next to or near a walleye lake? Is it near a trout stream? So that could be packaged potentially to help you and applicants vet proposals. And then finally, I just want to say that, respecting your time here today, that we're available to strategize with you about how to incorporate these in a short-term strategic planning process and a longer-term strategic planning process. And whether it's to develop a scoring system, whether it's to develop priorities in a mapped statewide perspective on many different levels, we could incorporate that. So.
Great. Thank you. Questions or comments for either Steve or Gene? So we've both had a chance to take. Oh, Phil.
Yes, I wanted to ask Steve, could you give a couple of examples of what the, what do you call them, goals or objectives in an ecoregion might look like?
Sure. Steve? Mr. Chair, Bill, if you take things like the duck plan, for instance. We took the duck plan that had broad goals for a big area in terms of acreage and broke that down into how many acres would that really mean in terms of habitat in different subsections? So there were those kind of specific targets in terms of habitat. And then when we took those targets out to the group, they talked about different ways that that might come about, you know, whether it was, you know, protect a certain area or ease a certain area or habitat restoration work or whatever it was.
And, Gene, is it correct, my understanding correct, that what you're suggesting one might do is, given specific targets like that, using the mapping, you could make a estimate of where best that those acres ought to be protected in terms of bang for the buck, multi-species protection, things like that?
Correct. The databases could be developed into a model that could incorporate priorities, criteria set by the council. It could also incorporate additional databases such as the assessment databases, conservation easement values across the state. And so, yes, I do believe that it could be used that way.
Thank you. I thought that's what you said.
Yeah.
Any comments?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if this is maybe a question or not, but we have an obligation to develop now a 25-year strategic plan, and we're supposed to use everybody else's plans to develop what those plans are. And I'm mindful that's a lot of good work that's been done, and I'm trying to think, you know, Gene, could you take this law and come back to us and say, here's a 25-year plan and an asset allocation model and similar to what Ryan had put together, given a cash flow projection for the next 10 years that says, here's how you need to invest.
Mr.
Specifically.
Chair, thank you for that question, Mr. Sherwood. I do believe that we could assemble the databases necessary based on the criteria, which is the part that the vision plays in, and develop a model that could prioritize at various scales across the state for 10 to 25 years. I don't think I could do it this summer.
Well, we've got to January.
That's why I said for the longer term and the 25-year, it is certainly possible, and I can imagine a work plan to get to that point.
Cool. What could you do this summer?
To clarify, for us.
Great.
Free for us. By tomorrow.
And, Mr. Chair, thank you for putting me on the spotlight. What we could do for you this summer is certainly bring the information that we do have assembled and make it accessible and show you in our beta version how it can be accessed using your questions and your criteria. That's what we could do over the summer. You know, there are certainly facilitation aspects that the 50-year vision group might be able to offer, although I don't need to speak.
Mr. Richard and members, we have a letter from Paul Austin, and as part of the campaign for conservation, that's for the folks that put together the 50-year vision. I think we're also willing to help in trying to get the word out as well. I should also mention, in terms of, you know, putting together kind of the targets and a strategic plan of some kind, there are some good examples to look at, and we've looked at some of those too around the country in terms of developing the process that ultimately builds the thing you want to build. And so I think there are some things we can look at and assist you in from that standpoint too, in terms of looking at how to really develop a mechanism that gets you what you want in terms of the final outcomes.
Let's do a quick question. Looking at the 33% from the council, we'll start out the Heritage Council, are you equally incorporating the clean water and parks and trails part of it into that plan?
Steve?
Mr. Chair, members, I would sure like to. I mean, at least from my perspective, I think, you know, we're looking at, you know, how this all comes together, and I think when a lot of us were really thinking about some kind of dedicated funding source, we really were looking at trying to integrate all the things like clean water. And you know, I look at some of the efforts that even are being done here in the metro with some of the watershed districts. They're looking at water, and clean water is one of their primary goals, but they're also developing conservation plans that will accomplish that. And we really are integrating those things. And I think we can do that kind of thing, I hope so, at a statewide level. Jean?
If I could, Mr. Chair and Mr. Bench, the statewide plan recommendations are broader than just terrestrial or wetland or recommendations. They also include great recommendations for water quality and some for parks and trails, although not very well. The database itself, though, I want to emphasize that we looked at both aquatic in-stream, in-lake habitat and the associated terrestrial habitat and just terrestrial habitat. So getting to the in-lake questions that Mr. Qualley spoke about, we have good information on that, and if the questions were, where in the state do we have the best in-lake habitat, we could come up with some priorities. If the question were, where in the state are wetland complexes located near impaired waters and that we might prioritize those, we could identify those areas.
Questions or comments?
Just it seems to me, Mr. Chair, is that we have a vision. For the most part, Steve and his folks have taken all the stuff that's been out there and consolidated into a document, and that's kind of the first. We have a constitution, and that's our mission statement. We have a vision that now maybe doesn't directly emanate from that, but has a lot of the component parts to it. We have a lot of data that Jean and her folks have put together, and it seems that that's the next evolutionary step from there is to put specificity about on a prioritized basis where we're specifically going to invest on a geographic basis using the DNR section subsections and and a timeline with a cash flow projection.
I mean, what you've described, both of you, I mean, they're separate but obviously very interrelated, really does greatly jumpstart what I think we all intended to do. Was, we spent the whole day, 8 hours, reviewing the habitat resource plans. Steve, your group has not only done that, but you've broken out the goals by ecological subsection, which we're going to have some semblance of, whether it's subsection or section or some combination. And Gene, you've got more specific modeling data that says, okay, if we're looking at, let's say, wetlands, and where across the landscape are those highest value areas? So we've got elements of both, and I think the question that the council needs to wrestle with is how we can use that information, both of those documents and the information behind those, as we develop not only a plan for fiscal year coming up, the next fiscal year, 2011, but also that 25-year vision. And to be quite honest, I'm very impressed, and I think we'll be able to leverage a lot of what you've done. You really, I think, helped jumpstart the process we need to go through, because we all, I think, agree that everything we want to do is based on where the greatest conservation needs are. And in two separate ways, what you describe are simply products that look at it a couple similar but unique ways.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I would say that if it's going to be helpful, we can develop a proposal about how we can integrate those two things and bring that.
Well, that was where I was going was, without burdening you further, if you two would be willing to just put together something very brief that says how those two might work together, to kind of further what we're thinking about doing, that would be extremely helpful. Again, we're going to be wrestling with this over the next month until we lay out our next procedures or guiding process that will carry us through at least fiscal year 2011 recommendations. That would be really helpful. So if you're willing to do that, certainly.
And be sure, I have no problem burdening them further. And I would just say that, and the law.
Yeah. Okay. That's ever mindful of what the Constitution says, this fund can be used for. Absolutely. Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. And again, working with Bill to bring something back to us that does that would be very, very useful.
Happy to.
Members, what I want to do for just the next maybe 30 minutes or so is I want to get your reaction to kind of your thoughts. I know that you gave some thoughts in writing to Bill. We really haven't had a time to talk about this openly because we were so focused on developing our recommendations and getting input. But I guess I want to start the discussion, again, just free-flowing. We're not going to get any answers here, but this will be very helpful for the executive committee to bring something back in writing to the council in June to hopefully approve. And so the first thought I have is, as I look at the legislation and everything's predicated on the governor signing the bill into law, we're to develop a 25-year plan by January 15th of 2011. We need to develop our recommendations by January 15th, 2010. And so it seems to me that we've got two processes that really are parallel but are somewhat distinct. And I want to get your thoughts, to the extent they're congealing in your mind, about how we go about that. Because, you know, we'd love to be able to develop those 2011 recs with this 25-year vision in hand. I think we all have our notions of what that is, but I mean, realistically, we have to have our call for proposals done in about 4 months. And in as much as we heard a lot of this has been done, I'm just not quite sure. In fact, I'm very skeptical that we're able to take that and call that a 25-year plan. It may be a good start. But let's open it up for some discussion about how you see this unfolding over the next year. So starting out with kind of what's going to be our guiding force developing our 2011 recommendations, as well as how that relates to this longer 25-year plan. Rick.
I think a core issue is differentiating between stakeholders and public, that stakeholders are members of the public, but not all members of the public are stakeholders in terms of having either projects that will be becoming before the process or having requests coming at the same time. So involving the public is a goal that shapes the process and shapes the endpoint. I think one of the potential challenges we had with the short process was that you have stakeholders working in a collaborative process and dividing up the pie amongst themselves and bringing those recommendations to us. And I think it's a better process the more public involvement there is. So, and I think that's identified in a number of these letters, that the fear that there was exclusion rather than inclusion, because you have all the usual folks that are there working the issue and then also having the proposals that come from it. So I think in the next round and in the framework, you have to try to have things as broad as possible. Not saying the stakeholders don't have a role, but I think it needs to be a lesser role that doesn't give the perception that their role gets a certain outcome.
Rick, I guess I got a question for you. It sounds like you were really kind of saying you just sort of fully abandon the collaborative, any version of the collaborative. Is that an implication?
No, I think, Mr. Chair, I think you can have a collaborative. I think you have, but you have an independent, you know, maybe or facilitator, and you have those noticed well in advance, and you have them a little more public, and we have a little more time now for that type of thing. So it's, I think it's an issue of trying to assure folks that there's not, it's not a done deal when they go into there, and so that people are aware of it. There will be many more projects this year than there were in the short term, and there are projects that were ready to go, and the stakeholders know what's ready to go, but you are going to have a lot of large and small people who did not participate this first go-round that are going to come now, and they need to feel that they have the same shot at it as everybody else.
Scott?
How many of those people, Rick, are going to end up in the small grants program, do you think? I mean, we got a 0 to 400,000 there. I mean, I would see that that area is going to just get bombarded with proposals. I don't know that we're necessarily going to see a lot more proposals in the 400,000 up, and we might, but I think we need to make sure, when we talk about public input, making sure that Johnny Sportsman's Club's got an opportunity, I think that promoting that conservation partners program is the place we're going to be able to do that. You know, and I'm hoping that under our pilot project program, we're going to be able to get something out in the next 60 or 90 days that says, here's how you apply. I don't know if we can move that fast, but that's what I'm hoping for.
I think we're on the same track as part of that notification, because we don't want somebody to waste their time coming to a meeting that, you know, is, I mean,
that, and we tell them the same thing you just told them. I mean, most folks, I mean, just regular Joe or Jane citizen may not know about the small grants program. Stakeholders may know about the larger process, but they have a project, you know. So it's that notification and process and outreach that I think strengthens the process, and it doesn't. You get people to fit into where is the best program for them.
Les? Mr. Chair, in response to the comment, the stakeholders are made up of the public. If I could give an example, Ducks Unlimited, one of the projects, the Christina Project, is made up of clubs like Coots Unlimited. Yes, we do have a Coots Unlimited club in Otter Tail County. These are the smaller Ashby guys. They associated with the DU chapter of Christina. DU National gets involved. DU State gets involved. So I think a lot of the stakeholders are made up of the individuals out there, too, that are forming a collaborative effort. And if we channel the smaller grants through the small grants program, I think I'm interested in see how that one evolves and see what type of response we have, because I think that is the primary one where the smaller groups are going to have an opportunity to come in. And I would hopefully envision that at some point we're going to have to increase the funding for that small grants program to double what it is.
One of the things that I've been wrestling with, and I heard two different opinions about, I think everyone is agreeing that some form of a collaborative is really helpful. And what Rick is saying, I completely agree with. You know, they should be creatures of us, which means either we have a staff or someone that we have oversight over facilitates that. They're publicly noticed on our website and whatever. A couple questions come to mind. One is, if we all agree that these collaboratives are important, what do we focus those organizations, those entities around? We did it this last time based on the constitutional mission, prairies, wetlands, and forests, and habitat, kind of aquatic habitat or aquatic systems. Is that the focus? We also heard, you know, maybe these collaboratives should be geographically oriented. Let's say we take the state and we carve out five regions for the sake of argument. Now, what are your thoughts about if we were to engage people, do we rally them around geographic areas, or do we bring the people who really have a passion for wetland systems, and we get them excited and engaged in that area? To me, that those are two fundamentally different approaches to developing not only our vision, but also more near term, what recommendations we bring forward. Wayne?
You know, I think a lot of that's going to happen, and we're getting closer to that. We need to describe what the outcomes are. Excuse me, it's too much time in the woods yesterday. But we need to describe the outcomes. We need to be able to tell people, I think, this is what we want to see in Minnesota. People should tell us, and then we're regurgitating and saying, this is where we're headed, this is what we'd like to see. We want to restore X number of acres of wetlands. We want to do this, and we want to do that. And then we set it out there and say, you guys collaborate together to make these things happen. Well, we did this last time, Rob, is we said to the presenters, show us a project, tell us what the outcome is, and we'll tell you whether it's good enough or not, whether it meets some criteria that was there. And I think somewhere along the way here, and I think the number of us said that, we need to come up with this plan that dictates what we're looking for. And I think when that happens, people will, the organizations will generally rally around to make those things happen.
Others, other thoughts? Because, you know, as we think about between now and September, we have about 4 months to identify what that strategy and those priorities should be so we can put out a call and be much more targeted in what we're looking for. And you know, I hear what you're saying, Wayne. At some point, we need to decide, are we going to say folks that want to rally around the Prairie Pothole region of southwest Minnesota, we're going to facilitate a process to look at that region of the state, or are we going to say statewide, people that have a great interest in wetlands, we're going to bring those people together. And those are fundamentally different processes with likely different outcomes and priorities. And, you know, we can make a decision, but I want to hear from others about kind of where you see it shaking out. And maybe they're not as discreet as I'm describing them, but in my mind, I kind of sometimes think black and white. I see them as somewhat skewed. Ellen, tell us.
Well, I think the legislation has made it pretty clear that we need to focus over the long run, at least in terms of our planning process, on the regions. And I think we've heard a lot of support for that concept from a number of the folks who have talked today. And I think, over time, they are not going to be the exclusive way we solve problems. Absolutely. I mean, we are going to be talking about wetlands and prairies and other things separately. But I think it would be nice if in an ideal world, if we had more time than we do have, what are the 10 eco-regions of the state or something like that? 10 or 12 on that map?
Well, there's several different levels.
No, but the big picture ones. I mean, there's the three big, what do you call those, Greg? The three big
provinces. Actually, I think there might be four. I was thinking
four
three
provinces. I mean, we could, those are really big, and I would maybe narrow it a little beyond that, but ideally we'd go to each of those areas. We'd physically go there, and we'd have a, but that's where we would, how we could sort of shape our process for the next year, and we'd have a hearing, and we'd invite all folks from that area to come talk about what are the unique ecological features and needs of those areas. I'd love to see that happen and use that to help us at least think through the beginning of a plan for each of those areas, and we'd learn a lot and be able to identify what the needs are. Now, I don't know if our time permits us to do that in 1 year while we go ahead and go through our RFP process, but that would be sort of something I'd like to see happen gradually, I think.
Okay. Others?
I mean, a challenge that would occur if we said we really want to target those 90,000 acres of native prairies, the price would go up, probably. If we indicate that that's what we want.
Sure.
Because just human nature, there's a ready pool of money here, and if we really want that, it'll cost more to get it. Mm-hmm.
Scott?
How many of those 90,000 acres could be acquired, even if we had all the money on Earth? I have the very first piece of perpetual prairie easement in my whole county. It's a 17-acre parcel of property with my mom and dad. There was a 30-acre parcel directly north of it, and a guy by the name of Jason Garbs, who worked for the department at the time, worked in their prairie. I mean, he ran up and down that Canaranzi Creek watershed, trying his hardest to enroll those prairies, and everybody told him to go away. So, I mean, just because there's 90,000 acres out there doesn't mean that if we have all the money on Earth that we could get them anyway. They turned around and signed it up in a different CRP program and planted it full of red twig dogwoods, And I said, I was frustrated by that. But my question comes down to we make prairies a priority.
Right.
We have to make acquirable prairies a priority. And the reimbursement rate was really, I thought, very attractive. When they enrolled that 17 acres, they said, you can't. And some contracts allow you to graze it and do other things. But, to my folks, it was a good deal. But up and down that, 5 miles upstream and 5 miles downstream, everybody else just said forget it. So I don't, just because they're there doesn't necessarily mean they're acquirable, no matter how much money you have.
In terms of identifying priorities, for example, in the area that my background is, which is in forestry, I can tell you where I think some of the priority areas for forests are. If you put me in a geographic region, then I have a much harder time saying, well, forests are important, and they're more important than these, aquatic systems, these cold water streams, or this wetland. And that's where I'm really having difficulty, where we have to operationalize whatever we define. I can engage Ryan, for example. I don't want to pick on Ryan. He might not. There he is. He can tell me, and others who have a real, passion for wetlands, and they're wetland ecologists, where the most pressing needs are for wetland restoration. But if I say, Ryan, in the prairie pothole region of, the whatever that geographic region is of southwest Minnesota, look at that and kind of give me some judgment relative to native prairies and to forests and to aquatic systems, it becomes, I would guess, much harder because your area of expertise and interest in wetlands. So that's where I'm struggling with is how we will look at sub-state regions of some sort, but
how we engage in that process is still fuzzy in my mind. Wayne, and then Les.
Mike, you know, my original thought was a lot like Ellen's. I wanted to hear what people's concerns were for that particular area. So we were talking about county conservation review groups. Yeah. Groups getting together countywide and saying, this is what's going on in my county, and this is what's our top priority. And then when you put those together on a regional basis, you might find that this county and the next county and the next county all have the same concern. And now you get three people that maybe are three counties that haven't talked together before, collaborating them to say, we all together want this to happen. And that therefore, they are then, we're getting them together, you might say, to talk about things, but then they are the ones who are coming back and saying, this is what's important.
Les?
Reference to some major projects, we all were aware of the big disastrous area in the Red River this year, and Governor Plenty had met with Governor Holman, and they're proposing in the neighborhood of a $500 million levee system that probably won't solve the problem. All it'll do is exacerbate the problem further upstream. Talking with Henry Van Laughlin and some of the people down in that area, I think we have to aim at some of the projects that are down in that area. Some of the projects are barely impoundment projects, which doesn't fall under our constitutional dictate, but under the impoundment project, about 80% of that land is prime land surrounding those impoundment projects to be able to put into the preservation through easement programs that I think we can get certain state pressure on to help put some of those areas into easement programs. There's 23 rivers that flow into the Red all the way up to Kitson County, starting at Traverse. Three of the projects that we looked at this year, the Red Path, Mistinka, and the Manston Slough. These projects, I think, are major projects that can have a major significant impact on solving the problem, mitigating the problem, impoundment along with restoration of some of the prairies. They're talking about 500 million. Well, we're probably talking about 1.2 million acres from Lake Traverse all the way up to Kitson County that could actually solve that problem with one of the greatest green corridors in the entire United States if we could work with North Dakota. And I'm absolutely positive that they would be receptive to this. So I think some of those major projects are so critical. The ag community is going to be in opposition in certain cases, but the University of North Dakota just completed a study saying that by doing the impoundment, releasing the water, it's like flushing 25 toilets at one time in a building, you're going to cause a problem. But if you flush them one at a time, you're not going to create the problem. That's what impoundment is. And I think it has a lot of merits as far as putting this plan together and really looking at a lot of the periphery areas that we could create some very significant impact on the state as far as a disaster relief and future set-asides and restoration of the prairies and wetlands.
You know, one of the things, too, that I was thinking about is certainly however we engage through these collaboratives, either by resource area or by geographic area, it seems to me the council, too, has some priorities it can identify absent that. So, for example, Rick, I know you and I talked a lot about this and shared with the council. We want to take care of what we have first. And so as we think about developing that call for proposals for fiscal 2011, you know, we engage people up in the northwest region of the state. They're going to talk about their area. But one of the things I'd like to see is for the council to identify some strategic investment needs that might transcend all of those, like for all of the publicly owned lands, we'll take wildlife management areas, that our habitat is in good shape before we think about moving to acquire additional lands. And of course, we fully funded the restoration work that was proposed. Every dollar that was proposed from the DNR for restoration work for prairies, we funded. We recommended funding for that very purpose. And so I'd like to make sure the council doesn't lose sight of, while we want to engage and look at it on a regional basis, there might be some overarching principles that drive priorities that the council needs to think about as we move forward. Bob?
Mr. Chair, I think I'll make a couple of comments here. People will have confidence in the outcome if they have a confidence in the process, and that confidence in that process will be determined by whether or not they understand what happened. And I think the audience in this case is the legislature in January 15th of 2010. we want them to have confidence in the process that led to the outcomes of those recommendations. So rolling back from that timetable, if we shoot for September 1st as the time we outreach to the public and ask for responses, I think we should spend a significant amount of time being very clear about what it is we're asking for. I think we heard a number of good comments. This is an acquisition. If you worked over the department administration and you were asked to say, you know, I need to go acquire a desk, you have to do a requirements definition process. Describe what it is that you really want. It's like building a house. You can't just say you want to build a house. You have to describe specifically how many bedrooms, how many bathrooms, and each of the elements to that. And I think that's our job, is to describe specifically what it is we're asking for. The more we do on that front, the more likely we are to get what meets our expectations and our goals and objectives. And frankly, people will self-screen. You know, if we're very clear about things, and we ask for something, people respond if they can do it. They won't respond if they can't. So I think it's very important to us to do that. I think I'm going to try and make this think of this as simply as possible. We take the state. We've been asked by the legislature to use the regions and subregions of the state, overlay that with the Constitution. So in each of those regions, we look for the opportunities that have the highest value of prairies, wetlands, and forests, and the activities that can take place on any one of those, restoration, protection, or enhancement. Overlay that with the criteria that we have used before and that we'll modify further. Where can we get the most cost benefit out of those things? Where can we leverage the most dollars of somebody else? Where is it permanently protected or not? Where is it restoration work on high-value land, for example? And I think the more we invest in articulating our requirements based on the Constitution, the law, the plans that we have available to us, we're likely to get an outcome that people have confidence in because the process is clearly understood.
Darby. I would really echo a lot of what you said, Bob. And I have this business of, when we get back to the ecosystem regions and so forth, I have really thought long and hard on this, and I'll have to confess I've come full circle. Ecosystem or ecoregion organization is clearly important, but and I was really focusing my thoughts pretty heavily on that until I got to thinking about, you know, the constitutional statements of the four sort of we've been talking about in the silos. And I'm just wondering if we can't basically mesh those four silos, if that's the language you want to use, with appropriate ecoregions. I think that would call for relatively fewer ecoregions, but I think there are reasonable matches. And I don't think we would be mixing oranges and kumquats to accomplish it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Now, I may change my mind next week, but I mean that's sort of where I am now after pretty considerable thinking process trying to decide how do we manage this, all these ecoregions and sub-ecoregions with kind of the core, which is those four silos.
Bob, in response to that? Darby's saying that. I think that we may find that in ecoregion ecoregion A, we'll ask for proposals for the highest and best opportunities for prairies, wetlands, and forests. But we may know that in ecoregion A, forest land is not of great value there, because the targeted areas that are maybe better suited because it's a prairie pothole is prairies and wetlands. So it'll self-select in some respects because the forest opportunities that may not exist or be very, very small. Or frankly, could be incredibly high because they're so small.
But a diverse opinion in a different direction. In response to one of your statements you made earlier, Rick, the price and value of land. The ag community is in a precarious position right now. Their ethanol is a bust. The new ethanol plant, Fergus Falls, is bankrupt. The 95% of the land, the CRP land in eastern North Dakota, is under the plow. Talking with the seed companies and the seed dealers, the farmers are deciding whether to plant corn, soybeans, or wheat, and which one they'll lose less on.
I don't think that I think the $5,000 land value is an isolated incident. I think the easement prices are maybe very attractive in the next coming years. And unless the ethanol industry creates the cellulosic diversity, it's going to continue to have a problem.
Any other thoughts? I want to cut this off short, but so the plan would be that the executive committee is going to meet here very shortly, take all the input that we received in writing, people provided comments, and we're going to sit down and come back to you with a proposal, just as we did back in January, on how we plan to proceed. It tries to bring the great ideas we've heard today together, and so everyone, including not only us, but everyone else who's interested in the Outdoor Heritage Fund, how we plan to develop these recommendations.
Go just one more. Yeah. Remember, we haven't been too not successful, so let's not deviate too far from the path of success.
Right. Good point. And Bill.
And I think that we need counsel and input. I need it as we go forward. And I will do what we can do within the open meeting law to communicate with you all from me to get that input so that we don't end up on the 16th of June with a surprise or something like that. So I'll use the website and things of that sort and open it up to significant, I think, input in, as a result of that. I think we have to do that.
Absolutely. Wayne, you had asked that we talk about permanent easements, so the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the luxury of administering about 2,800 CRP contracts, and also highly involved in some RIM and some WRP contracts. And I swear in the last 3 months, I've heard from half of them the people that have these contracts because of the tax ramifications that have gone along with their conservation efforts. People that have permanent easements, their taxes have gone up 500%. Mine personally, on the WRP contract, put in a wetland restoration and a native prairie seeding to protect the waterway and a lake from the manure runoff that's coming from the lakes around it. I did it voluntarily, 20 acres, took the last of my cropland out. My tax structure went from homestead, a homestead, to something else, 700% increase in tax. I'm just stating this one because it's happening to everybody that I've talked to. People have said, how can you possibly come and tell me that a permanent easement is a good thing? People that are even in CRP have come in and said, it's unbelievable. My taxes went up 400% on a piece of CRP land because now all of a sudden they've got these nice, big, beautiful trees. They said, oh, it's worth all, you can lot that off now. And they're comparing it to lotted land. So I got a real concern when we sit here talking about permanent easements and conservation work and what's going on with the people that I have been in contact with. They're telling me, says, no way. If I had a choice, I would get out from underneath this permanent easement in a heartbeat. I just calculated mine up. 23 years, the additional tax that my kids hopefully will have to pay and not me. We'll take care of all the benefit I got for signing the permanent easement. Mm-hmm. 23 years. And we are in the process of trying to sell more WRP easements. What I'm concerned about is we're heading off in a direction. I think it's important for the people that are going to be signing these contracts to know the future. I got to tell you, my brother's in the same situation down in Watlin County, so it's not just in one county. He has a RIM easement on 120 acres. Permanent. Taxes went up 300 to 400%, something like that, for him this year, and he said it'll go up again next year because of some other property that's been sold. He said, hey, people are looking for that kind of a land for hunting. So now all of a sudden the value's gone up and they're comparing it with other pieces of property. I'm bringing that up only because I have a real problem with this. I'm working in a field where I'm trying to get people to do conservation work. We are sitting here with a large budget trying to get people to do conservation work, which we would rather do it with permanent easements so it wouldn't become a health problem for public ownership. But
how do we get people to buy into this if they know what's coming? There's a future tax consequence that nobody knows about. If you don't do a permanent easement, you have choices 5 years, 10 years down the road, because it's short term. Permanent easements at the will of the government, oh, all of a sudden that's worth that much more money or whatever, so we are going to tax you accordingly. I have a problem with permanent easements also,
Mr. Chair,
which I didn't have before.
Bob? Yeah, so Wayne, I'm trying to ask myself the question, what is your, are you trying to suggest that maybe that, that number one, we shouldn't have an expectation that permanent easements are something that are desirable by the landowner, or that the council should open the door to the notion that we any easements we do are not limited to just permanent, but perhaps time limited? I want to be sure I understand.
Or that we should just focus
our efforts on acquisition, fee-based acquisition.
Well, first of all, the first thing I thought of was acquisition. Maybe is the response, the answer to that. But I also know that there's some negativity about doing purchasing additional property for the state. And I can understand the purpose for the permanent easements, and I would actually prefer them myself. But I also know that with the tax liability, the way I see it this year, and the people that approach me about it, if this is true all over Minnesota, it's not just one county or two counties making their own rules up, that if people know the truth, how are we going to get people to want to sign a permanent easement when they know that down the road there is this potential to eat up any of the funds we give them in a permanent easement could be gone in as little as 15 to 20 years with additional taxation. And we have no, they have no control. We no longer have control. And it's a concern. I don't know if this is something that has to be brought up. I would like to be able to talk to anybody who is considering a permanent easement for any conservation project in the future and be able to at least advise them. You should probably go talk to your a tax consultant about what this means to you. There's a lot of surprises all of a sudden.
Alan, and then Wes.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's hard for me to not weigh in on this. I don't want to get political, but I just have to say, you know, as an aside to what was going on with legacy funds, the epic battle, the epic struggle of the legislative session has been all about how we're going to pay for things, whether it'll be through state taxes or local taxes, and local taxes keep winning. And that's what's going on with, you know, the legislature trying to use more state taxes to pay for the cost of public services, and the governor saying local taxes are the way to go and no state taxes. And with unallotments, cuts to aid, local government aid, and cuts to social services, that is just going to raise pressures on local governments to raise their rates, to raise their assessments, to raise every possible way they can to collect money. So, you know, I don't want to sound political. I'll get in a debate with Bob over there. But this is the reality as I see it, that's the way our state's going right now. And so I expect that pressure will just get worse and worse and worse for local government. So you're right to identify the problem. The solutions are very broad-ranging and beyond scope of this council. But that's,
Well, and just kind of on that point to both of you, you know, the current law is permissive. I've worked with county assessors for years on issues related to valuation, and I do research and other things related to that. It's very permissive. It says that if land is subject to a conservation easement, county assessor may or shall. It doesn't say this is how you deal with it. So you'll find, Wayne, some county assessors looking at a permanent conservation easement as a true right taken away and a reduction in value. You'll find others valuing what you're seeing, where it's, you know, based on comparable sales, that there's a higher value now because for outdoor recreation purposes. And there's really two things at play: is one, the valuation; one is the classification change, which you alluded to as well. So, I mean, you'll find 87 different ways that this is handled in Minnesota. Wes?
Wayne, Dean, we're both under the same county assessor, who is a very aggressive assessor. The last time this occurred, when you put a land in a conservation easement, it should be classified as a C2 classification, which is basically the lowest. You've given up the development rights, you've given up the farming,
rights. You've given up all the rights to it, so therefore the value of that land is categorically decreased. I would highly suggest you take it to the county commissioners and contest it and protest it unless the county assessor can stand on statutory law. His opinion is overweight.
Well, I put it this way, on behalf of a whole lot of people who asked me to find out what is going on, because everybody was so concerned, and personally I didn't have enough time in my office time to listen to all these complaints up here. I needed to find out. So I contacted the state municipal, the tax commission or whatever, and they said, so sorry, this is the way it is, and you don't have a leg to stand on, so that's the way it is. So the bottom line is, I see the way things are today. I always used to think that there was a definite advantage and a good reason to do conservation work, but there is a definite tax liability that appears to go along with that. And I am concerned that the future of us being able to sell people on the idea of permanent easements or conservation at all, based on the people that I've talked to this last couple weeks, is that don't come peddle conservation to me again. And this is really counterproductive to what we're here for.
It's an important issue. Well,
yeah, Mr. Chair, just to say that certainly everyone engaged in any real estate activity or that has tax issues should obviously consult with professionals on it and understand the long-term ramifications. I totally agree with that. In the end, it's little that the council is going to be able to do except to consider, urge those people to be sure that they go into it and it's buyer beware and understand what you're up against. And in the end, that's really all we're going to be able to do. And I think that, you know, the alternative is to not have a conservation easement and pay the higher tax rate, which is probably going up at the same rate as whether it's in a conservation easement or not. There's no doubt that for whatever reasons they may be, changes in valuation of property tax are going to have impacts broadly on conservation opportunity, development opportunity, and everything else. And they're not going in any other direction but up. I don't know what else to say. Except that,
well, I agree with you. I just thought, looking from a being in a position here where we're trying to do these things, and all of a sudden I'm finding obstacles which are hitting us head on. And I don't know whether there's anything we can do, but I do think it's something that what I said, was worth discussing.
Well, and Mr. Chair, you know, Representative Murphy, who was the House author of and chairs the, you know, the committee overseeing the funds in the House, she talked a lot about the need to have more dialogue back and forth with this council and with the legislative committees. And I think that's a really great idea. And I don't think the legislature is expecting this council to make policy recommendations about tax law, but there will be a process of dialogue and discussion where this is a really important issue that needs to be brought to the attention of legislators, too, because it is that kind of a bigger picture thing where we could try to change policy.
My concern is if we can't get people to agree to a permanent easements because of the tax liabilities, then our only option is going to be doing the public land thing, and
right.
Then we have to deal with tilt payments, and so there's a no-win situation.
And can I say a comment on this? Does this have anything to do with the Green Acres thing that passed in 2008? Or
some of it did, some of it didn't. It seems like there was people who shouldn't have been affected by it, but they weren't even signed up for Green Acres. All of a sudden, it just, they said, holy.
It's probably goodness. A classification change if we're talking about
it. It was mostly classification changes, and believing that it was just.
I think some of the things that the legislature did in an early tax bill may help in some of these situations. I think Representative Hanson, I think, maybe she carried the bill that Senator Metzen had on the Senate side. That is also going to allow for conservation land to be under a new category.
Right.
And some of those things, they may actually help with some of the concerns out there.
Well, that would be great.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, and they made, I think, a mistake in the 2008 tax bill when they said that that if you had an easement, a permanent easement, or on your CFP, you weren't eligible for Green Acres anymore. And that was something they corrected early on in this session.
Rick? And we'll wrap it up. Would it be helpful to get Bill some of these other pieces of legislation that have passed and maybe even get them out to folks? Because, you know, there's still work being done on summarizing pieces and, you know, some of these omnibus bills. But
and
if we can
really
find the pieces that are some of these tax things that we've talked about and some of the other portions, if we can get them to you electronically, can you get them out to everybody?
I certainly can. And in future meetings, I'm just sensing from what I've heard, I think we need to go over the clean water article mm-hmm. and the parks article. Mm-hmm. Maybe not both at the same meeting, but.
That'd be great.
Okay. So, Bob, one last point. The executive committee's going to meet and talk about developing these recommendations, I'd say. And just, I would suggest you start with the document that we created in January.
Absolutely.
That's it's not perfect, but it's better than a blank piece of paper.
Council should feel flattered that some of those very same guiding principles showed up in the House File 1231.
So, many of them.
Yeah, many of them. With that, motion to adjourn.
Are we going to talk schedule?
Yes. Okay, so hold off on that.
Bill? In your package, you've got potential meeting dates. I think what we're going to have to do is change the word potential by striking a line through it. Just agreeing these are the meeting dates that we have to have. And
So we'll have back-to-back meetings then in June and July?
Yeah, unless otherwise notified. And the Executive Council will flesh out the initial subjects of these particular meetings, and I'll be in contact with you.
Okay, Scott.
And these meetings are intended to be all around the state, from these state offices?
It's up to the Executive Council.
But the attendance is
publicly noted in the 19th.
Less than final comment?
Well, I think if we're going to make meetings out of state, I think we need to plan well in advance, because it's going to take some organization and state locations to set up the meetings. So let's determine the agenda, place, and time.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yeah, Bob, if you don't mind, I just want to mention, I thought a lot about that notion of getting out. And I know it's probably a bigger discussion we'll leave to the Executive Committee, maybe we'll talk about further, but my general view is we don't want to look at projects that are prospective recipients. I think that would be a mistake, and send an expectation level that will come back to bite us, and I think that would be problematic. I would suggest that we be very, very mindful of the cost associated with both time and dollars. Every committee of the legislature, every person in the executive branch is cutting their budgets, and I don't think it will help the council to be viewed as some roadblock. And my thought is that if we go out, it might be to look at specific activities that are as close to, frankly, the metro area, because that's where most of the council members are at, and to perhaps see a restoration activity on a prairie, an enhancement activity on a wetland. And personally, I don't need to see anything in forestry. I've seen quite a bit already. But to see how it's done right. And so we can have a backdrop to make judgments. But I'd be very cautious about it. I don't know if I'm off base or not.
I would echo that. There's going to be things happening in the next month here as the unallotments come down.
Right.
And, the idea that we could be on a road trip, is how it would be framed, I think would be very... very counterproductive, and so I think, in the executive committee, we can talk a little bit about that. But I think we should have a purpose and try to get into it and be very deliberative in what we're doing and have it clear as we do it.
And just on that point, Rick, it's a very good point in my notes, and one of the things I'd like out of the executive committee as well as using our developing a plan of what we do is on our field trips, what are the goals of the outcomes that we want to achieve by those? And from those goals or outcomes, we'll feel it can help us organize some field visits. But it has to be with a purpose. It can't be just go out there and look. But we need to learn something. Scott?
I understand that we're mindful of the costs, but haven't we almost been mandated to go out and mingle around in the public and have a meeting somewhere outstate, which would include a meeting of the council, which would then allow for public input at that meeting? Not requesting proposals or anything like that, but I mean, if we did went on four trips, okay, one overnight or somewhere, and every one of those included the opportunity for the public to come and meet the council and interact with the council, I think that those values and those benefits outweigh the potential negative that we went out mingling with the public and the costs associated with that.
Well, Mr. Chair, Scott, I'm kind of smiling, just thinking, welcome to the world of politicians. Yeah, because we have that conflict every time we do anything.
And if you do, Dan, if you don't.
Exactly, and I think people always appreciate it when we come out, we leave St. Paul and go to their community, but we're always criticized for doing it anyway because it costs money. But, you know, I think you're right. I think it's the right thing to do. We just do need to be a little careful in June. I have to point out, I'm not sure how this happened, but all but one of these days are the same as LCCMR dates, which is very unfortunate from my perspective. And I wonder if there's any chance that any of these trips will be combined with the LCCMR. Have you talked about that? Because I think those are probably maybe a little further along in their planning process. I mean, to be honest, I may have to appoint a designee to one or the other of these anyway, because I just simply don't have time to do both. But it's a little difficult.
Bill, response to that?
We did look at the LCCMR dates, and the idea was, I haven't followed up on it, to try to see if we couldn't do some stuff together.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't gone very far on that at all. And we'll just have to work as best we can with the days we've got, and maybe we'll have to find out. These were the days that I believe it was five or more members mm-hmm. could make it, said they could do it. It's very hard to get you all together.
I know.
Yeah. Any last comments? Back to motion to adjourn. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned. So we should sit down.
Probably
just not for Bill. Ranch out. You and I should sit down.